One, two. I was doing a lot of adjustment, so this will change. But one, two. It would. It also adds a little bit of noise. Although, I think yours is pretty quiet, right? One, two. Yeah, don't... As long as we know it sounds... Would you have the headphones?
Because I'm usually adjusting it a lot.
One, two, yeah. No buzz, no nothing. It's good. One, two.
The audio amplifiers and laptops are so weak anyway, it's really hard to hear decently.
so his knees work out well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he actually came from a regulated industry, which is
helpful. Oh, yeah.
He was from insurance, from Unum.
Yeah, and he really knew what, yeah.
Yeah, and he's used to dealing with states and, you know, also evolving policy.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not just like, well, here are the rules, follow them. It's
right.
Sort of unclear exactly what the rules are.
Right, right. I know when I was with Tosti, they had to do compliance and policy. They just split
that position. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's just huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Provocative, interesting, and entertaining.
We should have a talk show with an attitude like that.
May I have your attention? We're going to go ahead and get started.
I know. It's hard to see on the top, isn't it?
People can take their seats. And for those of you that are viewing this via webcast, welcome to our webcast viewers to the first ever NAG webcast internet conference. I think we've had a very interesting morning, a provocative lunch session. For those of you that don't know, I am not Christine Gregoire. I am the Janet Napolitano, the Attorney General of Arizona, and I've been asked to moderate this panel in Christine's absence. She has been required to stay in her state, something about all the state employees striking or walking off their job or something serious like that. So she's dealing with issues in the state of Washington, and we will deal here with issues involving the internet and the law and the internet. We are privileged to have quite a distinguished panel here for this first session of the afternoon. And before I kick us off with some questions, I'd like to just go down the row and have each of them introduce themselves and something about themselves. Susan?
My name is Susan Pinder, and I'm Manager of Government Relations with General Electric Company. I'm a tax lawyer by background, and you might all ask yourselves how it is that a tax lawyer gets involved in privacy, and that would take up the entire panel to answer, but I will tell you that the parallels between privacy and tax law are incredible. First of all, everyone has a story about privacy. It's very personal, and about taxes. And secondly, I think more importantly, the devil is in the details in both areas. I work for, as I said, for General Electric, a very large and complicated global company. I also sit as the chair of a coalition of about 20 global companies, Main Street, Wall Street, I guess, is the best way to describe this, but a cross-sectoral group. And so we try to look at privacy from a very holistic standpoint, from the standpoint of retail, financial services, insurance, and all across the board, and see the need to somehow try to integrate all of the different elements of privacy policy. It's important to my company. It's also important to the member companies that I work with.
Thank you, Susan. If privacy policies end up like the tax code, we'll be sure that nobody will understand them. Mike?
Hi, my name is Mike Baker. I'm EVP and General Counsel for Engage, a company here in Massachusetts. Engage is an advertising company, an internet advertising company that's affiliated with CMGI, the internet investment company. Engage, just real briefly, so you appreciate my background, is essentially a broker of advertising. And what I mean by that is we aggregate advertising inventory, spaces, holes on web pages from sellers, and this would be some over 4,000 websites. We aggregate all of that, and then we find buyers, Procter & Gamble or whomever, to place the banner ads in the holes on pages. So we really are a broker of online media, and I think in that role have a good perspective of sort of what's happening in the marketplace and, you know, whether ad-supported business models can sustain themselves and continue to provide content free of charge, as well as, you know, why business is keen to collect data to profile and otherwise try to increase the value of advertising inventory.
Paula?
Hi, I'm Paula Breening. I'm staff counsel with the Center for Democracy and Technology. CDT is an independent nonprofit public interest group that advocates free expression and user empowerment online. I come to CDT most directly from Trustee, the Online Internet SEAL program, where I worked with companies on writing privacy policies and implementing those policies and then acting in a sort of enforcement capacity as their director of compliance and policy. So I've sort of been in the trenches in that respect. And prior to that, I was with the Commerce Department, National Telecommunications and Information Administration, where I worked with the White House on internet policy, most particularly privacy, working with companies in the push towards a self-regulatory regime for privacy protection.
I'm Chris Kelly. I'm the Chief Privacy Officer of Excite at Home. We operate in a number of different businesses, from the Excite.com portal search engine to Blue Mountain Arts electronic greeting cards, web shots, online photo trading. We are also the largest broadband internet service provider with over 3.2 million people up on cable modems, and have a wholly owned digital marketing subsidiary called MatchLogic, which is in essentially the same type of business as Engage. And I just want to clarify one thing for Richard's comments earlier about where the information goes on the serving of the Cadillac ad. For those of you who saw Richard's demonstration, it will actually be sent back to MatchLogic with an anonymous ID that will, per the privacy policy, will only be linked with personally identifiable information on express user consent. So
very good. We all feel better.
Exactly. And let me add one quick note of personal privilege. It's particularly exciting to come back here at the Berkman Center. I worked with Jonathan Zittrain and Charlie Nesson to set things up here. This is exactly the type of forum that we envisioned, that we wanted to see, and I'm just thrilled to be part of this discussion.
Thank you, Chris. I think I'll just start with you. Do you agree with Senator Shelby that there needs to be federal privacy legislation and that the state should not be preempted?
So on the question of federal privacy legislation, I think I have fundamental comfort with the idea of federal privacy legislation. The question is, what are the details of it? What does it mandate? If you talk about fair information practices, notice and choice, those are fairly easy and straightforward. I mean, not perfectly easy, but those could be worked out. Access and security are harder questions, and enforcement, of course, if you go to the Fifth. Access is where all of the costs might lie with the actual provision of the data, and you'd be changing business models fairly radically. And security, security standards are changing all the time. The technology is changing all the time. It'd be very difficult to mandate, to have some federal standard on security. On the question of the states, I think as a matter of principle, because the internet is so ubiquitous, as we've heard today, that it's particularly difficult for states to get involved. And I have a little bit of a contrarian opinion to throw out, and I don't want to be a skunk at the garden party, but there's a significant argument to be made that states need express federal authorization to do privacy legislation as it would affect the internet because of the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. If you look at the anti-spam laws that have been passed in many states, in Washington and California, they've been struck down as violative of the dormant section of the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. In New York, the New York version of the Communications Decency Act was struck down as violative of the Commerce Clause. And so I think that's another factor that needs to be thrown into the mix here.
There may be some questions on that later. Paula, do you agree with Senator Shelby there needs to be federal privacy legislation? And if so, where do you stand on the preemption issue?
I do agree that there needs to be privacy legislation. And I think that that legislation needs to be put in a larger context. In CDT, we talk about a three-pronged approach to privacy protection that includes baseline legislation that would draw in bad actors and provide a sort of predictable, certain standard of expectation both for business and consumers. We think that has to be used in conjunction with the kinds of privacy-enhancing technologies that Danny Weitzman talked about earlier, not only P3P, but other technologies that are out there and being developed in the marketplace, as well as continued growth of the self-regulatory approach. A lot of work has been done in the last 4 or 5 years on self-regulation in the business sector, and there's been a lot of responsiveness to the particular needs of different kinds of companies, different kinds of business models. And the SEAL programs have also been very useful to be a first line of recourse, to engage in public education, to work with particularly small and medium-sized companies who need assistance in crafting privacy policies and implementing them online. In terms of state preemption, I'm going to be the unpopular person for the moment. We tend to believe that it's possible to have both good privacy protection. I just lost my train of thought. Both good privacy protection and a strong internet, and we believe that fundamental predictability and certainty that Senator Cantwell talked about today is going to be really, really important, and that ideally that can work with a federal legislation that would preempt state law. Having said that, however, it's important to keep in mind that the states continue to have a role, particularly as in the enforcement role when it comes to privacy protection, and also the enforcement role is going to be very, very important. And also, we're not going to be able to back any kind of legislation that would preempt state law unless we have a standard for privacy that's high enough that it's something that we can all live with. To have a low standard and preemption just would not be acceptable.
Mike? Same question.
I would, in theory, I agree with Chris. We'd be open to federal approaches to setting a baseline. I'm not sure it's time for that yet, however. What we've been focused on for the last 2.5 years as a company who's tried to deal proactively with legitimate concerns around privacy has been to improve the practices of the industry. And this has obviously been a difficult task in a rapidly growing industry run by 20-year-olds. But I think there are significant signs of progress. We and Excite are members of a group called the NAI, which is the Network Advertiser Initiative, and we've set baseline self-regulatory rules for the members to abide by. And this pertains to a particular aspect of the data use issue, which is these networks of advertisers creating interest scores for the purpose of targeting content. And this is really a quite natural commercial practice that occurs across all advertising media. And I feel good about where the group was able to get as a collective. We had quite divergent opinions as to what's acceptable and what's not, but nonetheless agreed on sort of a baseline approach. The next logical step is, how do we do compliance? That's always where the rubber meets the road. So I think everyone will be very focused and watching how this unfolds. But my point is, I think it's premature to sort of rush into codifying either the problem or the solution before we've worked incrementally through some of the sort of obvious approaches. I would include within that category of things enforcement actions against outliers in particular. I mean, believe it or not, I find that helpful, because it emphasizes the point that I'm trying to make to my constituents, that this is a real issue with ramifications if you don't do the right thing. And I think just recently the FTC actions for the children's privacy, I mean, we get calls, people notice that. And so I think there's a very legitimate role for federal and state regulatory authorities in sort of moving the industry along. But my view is federal legislation would be premature at this point, not only because of the industry efforts, but also because this is intertwined with technology issues. And for instance, on P3P, we've spent over a year basically negotiating and trying to understand what the standards are and trying to mesh, if you will, some of the normative policy and emerging legal standards with the technology and the business models. I can say right now, compliance is going to be something that industry has to be involved in, or it's just not going to work. It's too complicated. I mean, I can tell you, even within the company, for us to get the right answers, it can take a day of phone calls. And we're trying to create processes and communication paths that haven't existed before. So, really a law would be something that spurs those efforts along, but I think would be premature, and there are other symbolic gestures that we can take, with very real ramifications, as a group of people concerned about the issue, to actually create change short of enacting a law.
Do you think passage of USITA would also be premature? Do you think the area of that area needs to evolve as well?
Well, personally, I do. I feel that's sort of being thrust upon a lot of people, and that'll create. I mean, that's one way to do things. I think it could be done in a way that, frankly, is less disruptive and more efficient.
Okay. Susan?
First of all, speaking as the representative of a company that takes places great value and pride in its brand and ultimately in its reputation, I can say that we as a company are comfortable with the notion of federal legislation. I think the important question is not necessarily whether, but what form that takes. I think it's enormously important that legislation take on some balance. I think the notion of legislation, particularly as a way of getting at outliers, is important. I mean, we are a company that spends a great deal of effort and resources on compliance. We compete with companies from all over the world that may not have that same bent. So the idea of having a standard against which all members of the economy are measured makes a lot of sense. On the other hand, though, I think it's going to be striking the right balance, getting the right answer is far more important than whether we get that legislation this year or next. I would say that I think all of the fair information practices deserve a great deal of time and consideration. I would certainly commend the House Commerce Committee for their effort at this point in terms of educating both other members of Congress as well as the public in the different aspects and the complexity of some of these issues. Just sort of running down the list, I would say that when we talk about notice, the critical point here, the idea of informed consent, which Senator Shelby alluded to, I think makes a great deal of sense. It is, I believe, sort of the cornerstone of establishing good privacy policy. I think on the issue of choice, the thing that we have to be most cautious of is the idea of sort of sloganeering, the notion that this whole debate is as simple as opt-out versus opt-in. I personally don't think it's that simple, and I think we've got to avoid trying to characterize or polarize the debate in that way. I think access is a very, very important issue and one that may take us a great deal of time to work through, mostly because I think that in some ways access creates a very perverse incentive on the part for companies to do exactly what people are concerned about, and that is put together a customer-specific file. For a company as big and diverse, as global as the one that I work for, it's very difficult to know for sure that you're complying on an access request unless and until all that information is amalgamated in one file. We don't do that currently. There are not a lot of reasons for us to want to do that. So I think when we talk about access, again, and the notions of fraud, those kinds of considerations really have to be thought through very carefully. Security, I sort of harken back to the environmental world, sort of goals, the debate between goals and standards versus command and control. I think the important issue there is flexibility. And then finally on enforcement, I think the key there is making sure that the laws are predictable and fair in terms of awareness for the business community to comply, and I think there's some work to be done there as well. Now, on the issue of preemption, I think, you know, speaking as the representative again of a large company, in a perfect world, wouldn't preemption be wonderful? But we also understand that we work and live here in the United States, where the states have had responsibility historically for consumer protection issues, and we can appreciate the fact that there's a continuing interest in doing that. Again, we go back to the notion of uniformity, some degree of predictability, particularly in the online world, but in the offline world as well.
So would it be correct to say that you and Paul are kind of on preemption light in the sense that it would be preemption except to the degree of enforcement, but maybe Chris and Mike would be more complete preemption? Have I characterized your views adequately?
If I were an attorney general, I would want there to be preemption. I mean, not 100%, but I think this is a very difficult issue, which I'd rather spend time on some enforcement rather than policymaking.
And I would also say that the idea of enforcement of federal standards on the state AG level is something that I think most businesses are comfortable with.
I would just like to reiterate that preemption is only going to be appropriate if we have sufficiently high standard of privacy protection at the federal level, that we really don't believe in preemption for preemption's sake.
The initial exchange has to be a real trade-off.
Right.
Let me ask you another a follow-up question that, again, stems from our lunch discussion, which is unfair to Mike since he wasn't here for lunch, but he's flexible. And that is this. Do you think that to the extent we talk about privacy and privacy legislation, there ought to be different rules for online versus offline worlds? And I'll let whoever wants to pitch in first pitch in.
So I'll jump in. I mean, I think that ultimately we're talking about the protection of personal rights here, of people's comfort levels, of where they want to be, and what the industry should be doing and should be engaged in efforts like this. Otherwise, participation in the legislative process, et cetera, is creating a situation where people have more control over the information that's collected about them and over, you know, where that's discussed, how that's gathered, and that should be the whole crux of the process. There are a number of different things that contribute to that. There's law, there's technology, there's, you know, norms of and the way that the marketplace works in terms of pushing data in you know, one direction or another.
Speaking again from a rather a corporate perspective, I think as a practical matter, the thing that we all have to keep in mind is that information can be digitized or undigitized, if that's a word, with the press of a button. So I think it's important that perhaps the standards between online and offline transactions are generally the same, but that perhaps the implementation is different.
Microphone.
I would have to agree with Susan's comment. I think what we're really after here is to provide strong privacy protection across the board. You know, if you've got wonderful privacy protection online, but everything you turn over in terms of information on the telephone or when you walk into a department store is fair game, we really haven't accomplished very much. I think that some of that starts to be solved when more and more of our information is collected through the websites. But I think it's true that digitization is easy, and you can take what is not digital and make it digital very quickly and easily, and then you've really blurred the lines. So I think that sort of that bleeding in the middle is a very challenging piece of this debate. Having said that, though, I don't think that means that you don't move in the area of the online world. I think what computerization and e-commerce has done is forced us to focus on an issue that has existed in all kinds of information, not just online information, but it's become a point of discussion and it's raised awareness, and I think it is something we still need to address.
That's really refreshing to hear, and I know we're making progress with this whole public policy issue when people can express those kinds of comments across the spectrum of vested interests. I've never understood why online information is such a brouhaha and offline, well, look, that's settled. I just haven't understood that. I mean, one way you can try to understand it is descriptively to say, well, you know, the direct marketing industry sort of made their peace at a federal level, you know, in the 80s or whenever that was. And that's not going to be reopened just because, you know, they reached a deal. It makes very little sense to me that they'd be treated dissimilarly. People talk about digital information. There are new ways of collecting information, and I think that's what we need to focus on. A lot of this, frankly, is education, too. Do people know that, for instance, a cookie is being set when they're online and that collects information anonymously? Do they know when they type a name into a registration that a cookie could be set at that same time and thus a name and a cookie, to use industry jargon, could be match-coded? So I think there's a lot of education, but I think even being in a law school, I can't resist. I mean, from a First Amendment perspective, you would wonder, well, if there is some legitimate commercial interest at stake, commercial speech right, if you will, for the business in gathering some of this information and using it for marketing purposes, then we really need to be careful about delineating why offline and online are different. And, you know, there needs to be a real dividing line, and any sort of policy approach needs to be very, I think, tailored to the differences. And I would argue that we haven't really gone through that process. The public debate over this topic hasn't clearly delineated the difference.
One of the things we discussed at our table at lunch was in terms of the kinds of information being collected and its ability to be disseminated more quickly now than in the past, and how that perhaps should open up a discussion as to government records and what government records are considered public and how public. For example, this morning we saw Governor Dukakis's tax records up on a screen. We know now what his house costs. The federal courts are considering putting all federal court files and testimony on a database accessible on the Internet. The Domestic Relations Court in my state is considering putting all those case files available on the Internet. And those of us who've been litigators in court know those court files can sometimes contain information which, although public under the guise of public records laws, is fairly sensitive, intimate, and private in a way. Have you or your companies thought at all about the intersection between a federal privacy policy and how that interacts with other sources of information other than commercial information?
I mean, we've been focused on you know, sort of solely on working with the industry, or almost solely on the industry, with, you know, sort of building standards like the NAI process and working with organizations like Trustee to better define our policies and work things out. As, on a personal matter, I mean, as a personal issue, I would say that we should wait. We should look at this very carefully and consider these things and have public debate over this very issue. And we do have a tradition of the public availability of records, but one of the things that we have to remember as we discuss all the types of records that are created, kept, et cetera, through regular commerce or through interaction with the court system or through other government agencies, is how broad do we want that disclosure to be? There is a security in obscurity where if information is harder to get at, it's less likely to be searched. And that's a protection that a lot of people have taken for granted. And it's something where the legal basis and the basis for the public policy decisions that have been made in the past is being eroded by technology. And while I generally think that the standard should be uniform for online and offline information, the fact that the availability of offline information or information that was perceived as being traditionally offline is changing should be one of the factors that we consider as we discuss the privacy issue as a whole.
Other comments and
questions? I would say that it's a very difficult question. I don't profess to have the answers, but I would say that it does highlight an analysis that is at the heart of the entire privacy debate, and that is the notion of balance. I mean, fundamentally, the notion of public records, public government in this country is sort of what underlies our concept of democracy. Having said that, though, I mean, certainly on the other hand, we have a much broader access to that kind of information, and perhaps the attention should be focused more on abuse rather than on availability of that information. When I think about public records, I think back to my days as a law clerk, where I spent a lot of time at the Middlesex County Courthouse here digging through old property records and files to do title searches. I mean, that is that information, tax records, values, those kinds of things have always been, in many cases, out there and available for those who would go look for them. On the other hand, it's one thing to have them buried in a dusty old book in the Middlesex County Courthouse versus sort of spread across the Internet online. And I'm not sure ultimately where the answer is, but I think the important thing is trying to balance the notion of protection against certain harms, legitimate concerns about harms, versus the need or the value that we as a society place on open government.
I just wanted to make two comments on government records. I think one is that I think it's really important right now, as we're looking at the commercial space and the use of information, that we also be sure that, you know, we're doing our homework in terms of government collection of information. The Privacy Act was passed in 1974, and certainly a lot has happened in the last 27 years on how the government goes about collecting information, using it, and what computerization or what effective computerization has been. So we at CDT feel that this is a very important time to go back and look at that, and I think we've heard some things from the Congress, some comments saying that that's a direction that some members of Congress would like to go, so that government is doing its own homework and taking care of its own house, even as they ask the business community to do the same thing. And in terms of public records, I think it's a difficult dilemma, because I agree that, you know, there is freedom of information. We believe in putting sunshine on everything and making information as available as we possibly can. But at the same time, we're also asking people who want to participate in some very basic life events, you know, getting married, buying a home, buying a car, learning how to drive, licensing their car, participating in a business. We're asking them to turn over information for one purpose. That information is now being used for purposes they never originally intended. And I think that part of the analysis of this is to look at what the possibilities are for technologies to help us solve this. There may be a way that we can provide some kind of opt-out, much in the same way that we're asking the commercial space to provide an opt-out. We can provide that kind of opt-out in the government space as well, and use the technological capabilities that we're developing to help us do that on the grand scale that we'll need to have to do it if we're going to provide this right. Mike?
I enjoyed those comments. Listening to these the panelists, it occurs to me part of what everybody needs probably is a framework for analyzing the issue. And you can imagine in certain areas of the law, we have a highly evolved framework, like the First Amendment, for instance. I think when I try to solve real practical problems with privacy issues in my company, or think about a question like yours, government records, I think of two axes, if you will, that sort of grid the nature of the privacy interest. One is, what kind of information is it? And take two extremes. How about a social security number, which for your life will identify you uniquely, versus a click on a car website, which indicated that, you know, in 2 months you may have an interest in purchasing a car, and of course goes obsolete after that. The second axis would be, what is the collector of the information going to use it for? What's the purpose, the nature of the use? So you can imagine proving a fact at trial, or doing aggregate analysis of demand trends in the marketplace, or targeted marketing. And we could then parse targeted marketing into, you know, three or four subcategories. I think that in time, when we've got a better handle on this issue, we'll have much more agreement on kinds of information. And frankly, I think some people criticize the current legislative system as a patchwork and inchoate, et cetera. And I think, you know, there's something actually worthy of defending in the current climate, which is that in this country, we've taken a very sort of fact-specific approach to the issue. And I almost see that as reflecting what kind of data is this? How intrusive or how personal is it? And what is the kind of use? So I would just sort of urge that as a framework for thinking through a lot of these issues and starting to separate the very sort of strong concerns from the more sort of normal, ordinary concerns.
So you believe that there should be different levels of privacy protection depending on what the kind of information is that's being...
Yeah, I do. In fact, I'm speaking in the spirit of full disclosure, somewhat out of self-interest, commercial interest. But I mean, I really do believe in this approach. We at Engage, for instance, have said we're not going to use personal information at all. It's just not going to be something we use to market. We're going to use just anonymous information. And we'll try to distinguish ourselves competitively. And hopefully people will see there's a difference. So, for instance, if I tell you we have half the clicks you made online, and by the way, we don't profile any sensitive information, financial, sexual information, racial, religion, et cetera, I would hope an educated consumer would say, you know what, that's not such a bad thing. Why are you using it? I mean, so you've told me what kind of information it is. Why are you using it? Well, we're just doing it to choose the banner ad that you see. Is that it? It's like, yeah. Well, I mean, do I really care about that? Versus you actually have gone out to Axiom and Experian and got in my social, my credit header and everything else. Now you're populating my online behavior against that. Indiscriminately, and because there are no laws on point, just however you want to. I think what upset a lot of people and agitated them in the online sphere was the possibility of that kind of thing happening, which I can tell you as a business person in the field really hasn't occurred to date, which is not to say it's not an issue or that it won't occur, But I put those kinds of uses and kinds of information in very different buckets, and I think a rational regulatory, you know, be it self-regulatory or government regulatory regime will make those kinds of distinctions.
Other thoughts?
Yeah, I think the distinction between personally identifiable and non-personally identifiable information is an absolutely critical one. Largely because the space has been unregulated in non-personally identifiable information, a lot of very interesting business models have sprung up. I mean, Engage and MatchLogic's business models actually have helped fuel the availability of free content on the Internet. I mean, if there was not that subsidy that you get from getting higher return rates for targeted advertising, a lot fewer of the sites on the net would be free. That's a significant thing to consider. And the question is, I mean, if you step into the personally identifiable space and you begin to, you know, build a super profile, I think that you're touching sort of one of the two hot buttons that consumers have. One is just outright identity theft, a fear about their, you know, credit history, their credit numbers, et cetera, being, you know, fraudulently used, acquired and used. And the second is the building of a comprehensive, you know, super profile without permission. I mean, a lot of us want profiles built of us. I mean, I love the fact that I can go to Amazon and they can say, you know, the people who bought these books, who bought the books that you bought have also bought these books, so therefore you might be interested in them. That provides me with a deal service. I'm comfortable with that, and they've gotten very good at disclosing how they do that and why they do that. That sort of service is okay, but do I want Amazon out selling that to my life insurance company, to my, you know, to my credit card provider, to whoever else? No, not at all. And so people are very worried about the building of those profiles. If that's being done with personally identifiable information, that's a big deal. If there's, you know, an assessment of clickstream history on an anonymous browser and it's an NAI compliant company, which means that without explicit user permission, you can't link that anonymous data to personally identifiable information, I think that's a completely different story.
Susan or Paula?
I think on the issue of personally identifiable information, I guess I would make two points. The first is the distinction. I think that we are, as sort of a society, at least as a at least in this country, coming to some consensus about maybe what constitutes sensitive information versus less sensitive information. I think it's still a rather fluid concept, and again, here's a case where the details become enormously important when you talk about medical information. Well, what is medical information? Medical information is, you know, I think we can all agree, is your x-rays, your doctor's charts, those kinds of things. It's probably the information about the prescription drugs you take. But what about the payment history? What about the credit card receipts from those transactions? That's also financial information. It also indicates some history of payment. So I think we have to be very careful in defining at a very minute level what we mean when we say sensitive information. I think the other point is, and I think the other panelists sort of touched on this, is that we really need to focus not necessarily on the information itself and the use of that information, but more on perhaps on the abuse that, you know, you allude to the fact that what you read, for example. Some people may believe, and I think this is another point, that what you read is personal information. There are some people that would prefer that other people don't know what they read. I guess it depends on what you read. But I do think that again, we've got to be very careful and think these concepts sound very hard to disagree with at a very high level, but I think when you break them apart is where the debate really has to start, and I think that debate needs to evolve a bit. Paul?
Yes. I think that I always worry when you start getting into arguments about what's sensitive information and what isn't sensitive. I'm comfortable with the what's personally identifiable information and what isn't, but when you start talking about sensitivity, I think it becomes a really difficult discussion, because while I think Susan's right that we do have some consensus about financial information and medical information, when you start getting into other areas, what's sensitive to one person isn't sensitive to another, and what is in some contexts not sensitive becomes very sensitive in another. And I think that when you're in an environment where more and more information can be shared and linked and transferred, sort of the easy answers about sensitivity start to dissolve. And so I think you do come back in large part to the question of consumer choice and control. And so going back to those elements of fair information practice where notice and consent become really, really important. And yes, I agree, you know, if there is good notice and choice, that is one way to resolve it, but it really bumps up the need for robust notice that is understandable, whether by machine or by human, and then choice that's really effective. And I think a lot of the discussions around the opt-in is good or bad, and opt-out is bad or good, and sort of either-or kinds of discussions become a lot more difficult because of that sort of fuzziness around the edges of the definition of sensitivity. And I think those are going to be important questions to look at really, really closely as the debate comes forward.
I think we have time very quickly for one last question, and I'll ask you all to answer in 20 words or less. What scares you the most about the potential of federal legislation? And we'll start with Susan, since we started with Chris at the beginning.
Getting it wrong.
Three words.
the possibility that that we're going to make premature judgments on an issue that I think is enormously complicated and requires a great deal of thoughtful consideration in the interest of economic concerns, in the interest of personal concerns, and in a variety of ways.
What scares me most is, I guess, prejudging the outcome of a process that I think will largely be inflected, if not completely answered, by technology.
I think it's also getting it wrong, maybe for different reasons. I'm concerned that we do the right kind of legwork before we craft the legislation so that we really understand what we're talking about, and we're not just all sitting in separate corners, hurling the same rhetoric back and forth. CDT has a project that we're developing that we'd like to invite the members of NAG to participate in that will help us do that. And I think it's getting it wrong and not getting it strong enough so that it's something we can all live with, so that we don't have to come back and revisit this. I think that's going to be really important that we're not going to be able to get it all right the first time, but we've got to come pretty close to the target.
And my concerns are quite similar, but I'd put it a little bit differently and say it's finding the right level of generality to enshrine in the law. How do these actions get expressed as principles? I mean, they could be too specific and could restrict terribly legitimate, you know, business uses of information, or they could be too general and not really engender the type of confidence that we need people to have, and the confidence and trust that we need people to have in online transactions.
Very good. Before I close, let me see if there's any questions from the gallery here for our esteemed panel. Yeah.
I guess it necessarily affects that balance. I mean, the format, I mean, as we said earlier, the format that those records that appear in largely gives rise to just how easily disseminated they are or are not. And so it is, I think it is part of the balance of efficiency versus protection. And so it's an element. I don't know where it fits overall in the overall final equation, but I think it's important.
Yeah, and I want to make a quick point. I mean, paper is a technology. I mean, it is a technology for the capturing of information, the capturing and storage of information. I mean, that's one of the things that we have to keep in mind here as we look to establish principles. It's just a different means of capturing the information, and we have to ask ourselves the question as to what does the shift mean? Do we need to shift the principles, or do we just need to make sure that the law adequately addresses the changed circumstance?
Any other questions? Please join me in thanking our panelists.
How you doing?
It's another thing to have that information for government to sell it. And so it's really, I think, those who have
The part of that idea that
like it that we really know how they feel. But you know, so I mean, in a sense, there's part of me that says, I don't even care about what the rules are. I just think they set rules, so you know, it's kind of fun. So I think, you know, selecting a forum certainly helps with that. So we're basically
the first one, you know, the reason for
that. The majority of our employees in the top 100% of us in Massachusetts and have their different service links.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, this is in content. I don't know how the minimum of the next day in a where there's sort of a competition, if you will, for who's probably going to go under. I mean, for corporations, that certainly has been the
thing
of Mexico and Delaware. But yeah, I mean,
absolutely.
I'm not sure what it would be known as.
Unless you want to walk around at all.
For people to try different things. And just trying to understand generally what's being included and what's not, and what's the baseline legislative standard. You have to actually make reference to 10 different codes to understand
that.
It's here.
Fumbling around the door.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Right. Nice to meet you. Yeah. How would you feel as a state if you had consumers who are using a service with a company that's governed by a state with more lax laws?
Hi. Sure. I can tell you that my folks will refer you direct back to our press people that I'd be glad to. Sure. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very thought-provoking. It is. I mean, are there other examples where that's been done?
Right.
That's the first time I've heard that. It is not
really. It's not my idea.
My gut is it wouldn't work. But it is interesting.
Pleasure meeting
you. Nice to meet you.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll run into each other at
the door. I hope so. We'll come back around and see.
Right.
Take care.
Yeah. Great presentation. Thank you. Very thoughtful. Great fun to do. Interesting topic. Yeah. No shortage of ways to look at it and think about it.
Yeah. Well, and thank you. You're so highly recommended.
Yeah.
There and other industries. Sure. Everybody should sit on and talk to the FDA too about what they're supposed to do.
You even have a GLB risk.
Exactly. I mean, we're getting that under our belt. But the newest global, we just went to a compliance seminar last week about the interpretation of what we're going to do.
Right.
We are going to have to demonstrate consumer confidence that they indeed have proper
culture. Absolutely.
And it is our burden to demonstrate. And I know a lot of community banks.
Oh, I know. And then, it's just going to emulate into the industry.
Oh, that's what I was saying. I said, we do need these regulations because otherwise we're going to be left out of
European trade. Yeah, but unfortunately, the Europeans have not deigned to find Gramm-Leach-Bliley adequate yet.
Pardon?
The Europeans have not found Gramm-Leach-Bliley to provide adequate protection.
Well, I think they're right.
And so what we're, in fact, one of the things that I have very much involved with in the last several months has been working with Treasury and working with a number of folks to try and get Treasury to start looking at that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a ton of work to do there. Yeah. We're not in safe harbor.
Right. Well, now we're being talked about because I have a dual account. We have a transactional website, plus we are a web portal for nonprofit donations online. So I had to dive into all that last year, and that's why I'm adding to, you know, even the contact. How do you contact people?
Exactly.
Every way, mail, you know, that's what
yeah.
will be included too. You know, so it's totally legitimate.
Yes, Roger, don't be.
We're here too.
Yeah.
It's not this thing out on the internet with no tricks or no
exactly.
So I think that's.
It's tough. I mean, it's fascinating. It's a great area to work in. Really.
Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah.
This makes it more interesting.
It does, yeah. It's a good forum, and we need to do more of it in general.
Well, and last year, well, it was interesting because up and through Y2K, you know, being audited by the FDIC, they were all concerned about that. And last year, it was like all the rules changed. All the processes we had done before, now they aren't acceptable anymore.
Okay,
so how do we step up to the
plate?
Start over. Yeah, they really took it to task last year. But, you know, that was
That's right.
Never dull.
Never dull.
Rick is the analyst here. I don't see anybody.
Chris is right there. And,
well, he's your panel. I'm in the next panel.
Oh, your panel.
Yeah,
oh.
My panel.
Oh.
Let's see.
Oh, okay. You have to learn that stat there.
There you go.
Okay.
I'd love to. Very nice to meet you.
Bye.
I think it's really good.
understand the question. That's too large. And the thing that the state you have is not a corporation. I'm sure that they are much more. So,
I'm going to go
Check 1-2.
Can I just swap my machine in
there? Sure, yes. You have it on your hard drive, that's why.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, you just
you slide this to the right and pull up the
One amount of 1.5 wall power is up right here.
Oh, okay. I think I got plenty of power.
Yeah, you're probably good. You're not first though, right? You're after.
I think I am first. I think we just switched the order.
Oh, really? Okay.
Right, changed the batting order in mid game there.
Miller, one of the panelists, and I have a PowerPoint presentation.
Let's hope so. I have it on my laptop. Yes, indeedy.
There's a grab right here.
I don't know what you order. I'm the third person down.
We need to find Harris.
Maybe different than.
Okay.
Here's Harris.
Are you Harris? Oh, good.
I'm running in and out of here.
I think we're going to have to go.
Okay. Alrighty.
We're going to do a few five.
Okay. And fly.
Thank you.
for crying. That's the right one. How's Mr. John doing? How's your husband doing? Should I save it on the C drive or you can just leave here?
Do that for you.
Okay. What are we trying to do with the cell here? Edit? Icon. Okay.
Hi, Eric. Good to see you. How are you doing?
Me too.
A little bit. Howard, or?
I do. Yeah. Oh, he's all over the world.
Pathetic as usual.
Oh, yeah.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Eric. Good to see you. How are you?
Good. I think I'll use it.
How's everyone at ICAA?
We're doing great. We're
good.
Doing great.
I see Mark an awful lot around town.
You left me, though.
Huh?
Mark, I'm from Mark Pearl.
Mark Pearl.
Mark, I'm with you. I'd love to meet Mark Pearl.
Chris says 90-second warning. We'll give you a 90-second warning here and then begin.
Because I'm really
into it. It's probably too late to synchronize what we're all talking about.
Well, I'm talking about actors.
Are you
talking? Yeah, right.
A very small.
And you're talking about security for the most part?
Yeah.
I've got to go to this lawsuit.
Hey, thanks. We'll get started again. The next hour will be spent on access and security. Access is maybe an under-discussed set of issues, and we're going to try and change that with this panel and get into the access issues because they're important. Security are a set of sensitive issues to everybody. In fact, the precursor for all of this probably was identity theft or identity fraud that all of us have dealt with it one way or another, and it's just a nightmare for law enforcement people, but of course an even greater nightmare for the victim to experience that and then try and cure the aftermath of an identity fraud. We have a very good group with us this afternoon, as all the other panels, of course, have been. The format is going to be for each one of them to speak for 5 to 10 minutes, and then we might throw it open a little bit to the panel to go back and forth if there seems to be sort of issues or viewpoints that gel in that way, and then throw it open to everybody for comments and questions. It'll be very informal. We're going to start with Pete Bowden. If you look on your program where it says security expert, that's his other name, and a fitting name. He has a wealth of background and experience in the security area. He was with Deloitte & Touche for 7 years and worked on these kinds of issues. Has been at Microsoft for the last 3 years and is their sort of a security person. So Pete, we welcome you and take it away. Do you want to come up here or do you want to sit there?
I'll come up there.
Okay.
First of all, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. It's a pleasure to be here in a place where it's not raining all the time and also without having to testify for anything. I've got a few slides that just frame the context of security at Microsoft, and I think the issues here are very similar to private and public sector issues, but essentially the scale varies a little bit, and I'll talk about how. What I want you to walk away with at the end of this hour is that security is really the fourth piece of the three-legged stool that we talked about this morning with law enforcement, privacy, security. Without security, and we'll talk about some of the specific issues, those things tend to fall apart. So I think they're intermarried with the privacy discussion. And I heard several comments this morning that will tee up nicely some of the issues that I'll talk about in my presentation. You have to excuse the busyness of this slide. The point I'm trying to make here is that the scale at Microsoft is massive in terms of the issues we're dealing with and the volumes we're dealing with. We have today about 200,000 networked computers at Microsoft, 400 locations across the world that are that we have IT consumers. Our network handles over 6 million pieces of email every day. We have over 800 line of business applications. And on the average day, we face approximately 10,000 intrusion attempts. So the issues of security for us are not only significant issues, but there are a lot of them. My team, to give you a little bit of context, at Microsoft is responsible for working with systems owners, both Microsoft business systems owners and our partners, to secure those systems and make sure that we're not vulnerable to threats from the internet or through other partners' business systems. Very quickly, the key components of what we're thinking about when we talk about security. Access and authentication were two of the key points that John Gage made this morning. These are really the two biggies on the list. Access meaning, who are you going to provide access to your information? Authentication being, is that person really who they say they are? Also wrapped into this list are confidentiality. Is that data secure from point to point? Is what I'm saying to you the message that you're receiving, and vice versa, and are you the only person receiving it? Integrity, meaning can that data be changed from point to point as that message is delivered and returned? Non-repudiation gets to the heart of these tamper-proof transactions, which is very important for us. We have about 7,000 partners that are interconnected to our own business systems, so this is a key component of our security model. And then business continuity, which is something that hasn't been mentioned today, but it's a very important aspect of security, meaning after an event, how quickly can you resume business, and is there any harm done to your business after the security incident? The major components of our own security management strategy, threat and vulnerability assessment. Obviously, given the scale of the issues that we're dealing with today, it's of critical importance that we understand what's important and what's not to us. So every threat and vulnerability that we become aware of instantly goes through a quick cost-benefit analysis, if you will. And those that are important are the things we work on. Obviously, a lot of the things that we face on a daily basis are not important. I talked about 10,000 intrusion attempts every day. 98.5% of those are instantly rejected by the systems we have guarding our perimeter. The other 1% are things that we have to engage and interact with to defend ourselves. Security network design, meaning let's get it right the first time. My team works directly with the systems owners when systems are built to make sure that those things are built securely and then maintained securely. If they're not, obviously they're a major risk to our corporation and all of our partners. Security auditing gets to, if there's an event, and I guarantee there will be, everybody who's got systems facing the internet, everybody who's got systems connected to another system, is going to be the victim of a security incident at some point. And at that point, the question becomes, how do we respond? How do we figure out what happened? And how do we get to the law enforcement stage? Meaning, can we criminally prosecute somebody? Can we recover damages on those issues? Intrusion detection are the guardian systems at the gate, if you will. The vast majority of intrusions are caught and rejected at that point, and that saves us a tremendous amount of work. Rapid response to new threats gets at sort of the ubiquity of the information out there on the internet about how to hack business systems. There are tens of thousands of sites available that distribute tools that can be used to gain access to corporate systems. We have a small team of what we call white hat hackers, which are the good guys, which monitor these sites, monitor the conversations going on between hacker communities, and try to learn what's going on, what's hot, and how to respond to it before it happens. Policy enforcement here refers to not only policies at the corporate level with respect to usage of our systems, but also to the tools we have available on our information technology systems that can prevent misuse of our corporate network. And then finally, education and awareness. About 80% of the events that we face on a daily, weekly, yearly basis are what we kindly refer to as stupid user tricks, which obviously doesn't mean the user is stupid, but it's an educational issue in terms of if that user had the right information, they could have made a decision about securing the data, securing the transmission, and we would have never been faced with an event. So we put a lot of focus and emphasis on education. These are what I think, this is my final slide, and these are what I think are really the key security issues over the next 2 to 3 years that we're facing today and that we will be facing in the near term as the internet moves forward to its next stage in its life cycle. Integrating systems is something that wasn't really an issue when I started my career. There weren't a whole lot of integrated systems, and then we kind of came into this era of the integrated accounting system, and then all of a sudden HR was integrated with accounting systems, and now virtually every system we have needs to talk to another system, and this sort of creates the weakest link. Let's see if I can say that weakest link model, to steal the catchphrase from network television now. Whatever that weakest link in the chain is where the professional hacker will try to exploit, and that's what we're dealing with when we talk about systems now. We're not talking about just a standalone system. We're talking about systems that are interdependent on one another for security. Integrating partners and customers, again, several years ago this was not a primary concern. Now it is. We share intellectual property with partners and software providers. We share our systems with our customers so that they can bill and that we can recover revenue. And all of these things are interlinked. And every time we have a Microsoft system owner saying, hey, I've built this, I want to put it out there on the internet, we have to work directly with the folks that are using the system to make sure that it's secure also. My fourth point here is moving from moats to lockboxes, to steal a phrase from the former vice president. What I'm getting at here is this philosophy is changing from the hard outer shell network, meaning it's not good enough anymore to build the moat around the castle because we build so many bridges so that folks can do business with us. We've got, as I said earlier, 7,000 business partners, all that need to transact with Microsoft. Every time we add a partner, we add a bridge over the moat. So we've shifted our thinking from let's get rid of this hard outer shell and let's secure what's really valuable. If you're going to invite 50 people a day to your house, you probably wouldn't want barbed wire around your property. You probably just want to put your valuables in a small safe and leave it sitting there. Oops. My fifth point here is that there's just an outright lack of standards and interoperability. My takeaway from the P3P presentation this morning was that while there's a great amount of focus on privacy and creating standards around privacy, there's not a lot of focus today around standards for security and on creating a common taxonomy so that we can talk about what it means to be secure and what it means to be unsecure. Consumer trust is the hurdle that we have to jump over. Today we've got plenty of folks that are willing to put their credit cards on the internet. We don't have too many folks that are comfortable putting their medical history, financial information, or other personal information out there on the internet. And I think it's more than an issue of folks not understanding security, because I really don't think the customer or the consumer really wants to understand how a firewall works or how encryption algorithms work so that their data is protected. They just want to know it works. And we need to do some expectation setting similar to the privacy discussion around what is security and what does it mean for systems to be secure that are connected to the internet and are capturing your own personal information. I'm pretty comfortable putting my credit card out there knowing there's a $50 liability limit and Visa will take care of the rest if somebody abuses my credit card. I'm not near as comfortable putting medical information or other personal information out there. My second to last point here, there's a lack of focus on the PC and the server. Where there's been standards created today is in the area of transmission of the data. SSL, Secure Socket Layer, is the de facto standard for that across the internet. There's very little focus on the PC, and most of the time it's because it's close to you, and people are inherently responsible for securing what they belong or what belongs to them. But I don't know, has anybody used the kiosks downstairs in the basement today? I don't know. There's plenty of folks down there using them, and I noticed a couple of people were what appeared to be trading stocks online. Those PCs aren't owned by the person who's looking at their portfolio at the given moment, and there really is no assurance that that machine is secure. And it's the same thing for people's homes. Anybody have a broadband persistent connection to the internet, DSL, ISDN? Show hands, anybody? Same number of hands for folks running firewall products at home. Not as many. Close. That's great. Those connections are just wide open to the same kind of attacks that we face on a daily basis. And then my final point here is that the evolution of the web to this next generation of services on the internet is just going to create a target-rich environment for the bad guys. Senator Cantwell talked about Hailstorm. That whole service is built around the model that we are going to share that kind of information, and that kind of information is going to be used by various services across the internet. The foundation of that thinking is built on security, and without it, it just won't succeed. And we just won't be able to get to that next level. I'm going to wrap up here and hopefully leave some time for questions at the end, and let our next speaker take over.
Thanks, Pete. Thank you very much. Our next speaker probably relates to more organizations than anybody in this room. His name is Harris Miller. He's president of the Information Technology Association of America. This is the oldest and largest such organization. It has 26,000 members, from software companies to telecommunications to e-commerce. And if that's not enough, he's the president of the World Information Technology and Services Alliance, which Harris is, 41 high-tech trade organizations worldwide. He's written widely on these subjects. He's testified before Congress and at state legislatures, and has spoken widely as well. Harris, we're glad to have you.
Well, thank you, Cousin Tom. No, we're not related. I was wondering whether you're going to have an organization called the National Association of Former Attorneys General. I see my good friend Mary Sue Terry here, Jeff Modisette, the former executive director, Chris Milligan. Do you have an alumni organization? Well, I see the alumni have turned out well. It's good to be here. I'm a little nervous about speaking here at Harvard. The last time I was here was for a panel of the candidates for the ICANN Board of Elections. Back in November, the Berkman Center sponsored that and had the seven candidates here. And I came up and Jonathan Zittrain led it. It was very interesting. I was the official nominee of the board of directors, and I finished fourth in the voting. So I'm not sure that coming to Harvard is good for my future, but I'll come here anyhow and see what we can talk about today. I think this is a great topic because I think security is very important, and I'll try to cover that briefly in my slides today. Just briefly about ICA, we are a national trade association. We represent companies and organizations around the United States and around the globe. Also, we're affiliated with the Massachusetts Software Council, which is represented here today. Hello, Bruce, how are you? So we also work very closely with regional associations also. In terms of the agenda for today, I just want to make three general points. First of all, the general point is that the marketplace is really the way to protect privacy. Secondly, when you talk to consumers and you ask them what they're concerned about and they say privacy, when you drill down and ask them what they're really thinking about, it is security, which emphasizes the point that Pete was making in his presentation. And thirdly, when we do deal with these challenges in the security area, the issues must be addressed not just nationally but internationally, and not just in the public sector but also in the private sector. I'm not going to go through this in great detail because there have been lots of other panelists talking about privacy, but just to give you ICA's perspective, we don't think there is a necessity in any way, shape, or form for federal legislation on consumer protection online. We think the industry is the best solution. Certainly there should be specific areas that are already covered under the law, financial services, health information, children online. Also believe there should be strong penalties against fraud. But the real issue in the commercial transactions, we really believe, is giving consumers as much choice as possible, giving them the technological solutions I know Danny Weitzner covered earlier today, and also making sure there's uniformity. Industry should work more to develop its own self-regulatory standards, but what we don't want is the federal law or confusing state or international laws. If there are going to be penalties, the penalties should be proportionate. There should be strong penalties for people who are fraudulent in their use of the internet or promise to use data for one reason and then use it for another. And if there is going to be any selection of any technologies, they should always be neutral. We don't want to select one technology over another. We do believe that the marketplace is already offering many solutions, P3P, anonymizers, filters, third-party services. We also see a movement toward more and more organizations, commercial organizations, moving online. But let's talk about this second issue, which I think is really the issue we need to focus on in terms of what people say. I see surveys on, say, 80-85% of people, when they're surveyed in the American public, say they're concerned about privacy on the Internet. My question is, why aren't 100% of the people concerned? Everyone should be concerned about privacy on the Internet, if you're talking about the information being used in an appropriate way. And in fact, when you drill down, most of the concerns are about not privacy per se, but about security. Some of the issues that Pete talked about. Having the sense that when you transmit information, it is going to go forward in a way that is not going to be intercepted, and that also when it gets to its destination, it is protected there. Too many times we hear about stories where a company has good security for the information coming out, but as Pete pointed out in his presentation, the information is taken outside the back door. CD Universe was a big example last year where someone broke in and stole the credit card records of several hundred thousand people. And of course, we had the more recent example of the attendees of the Davos conference, and some of the most prominent people in the world had personal information about them stolen, not because someone intercepted the communications, but because someone broke into the database, which was not sufficiently secure. People are concerned about fraud. People are concerned about hacker intrusions. People are concerned about viruses. People are concerned about terrorism. We, in fact, did a survey late last summer in conjunction with EDF, Electronic Data Systems, one of the largest global systems integrators, and this is what the survey found. We asked people, do you feel threatened or concerned about cybercrime? And 67% said yes, and 25% said no. No. Another former attorney general, another Miller here. Good to see Andy. How are you, sir? Another cousin. It's very clear in this message that the American people feel very strongly that there is a threat to their security on the Internet. And we ask this question from the selfish perspective of industry. What are some of the inhibitors in getting Internet commerce to the level where we believe it could and should be? And the answer clearly is that people are very concerned about their information. So this is a market inhibitor. This is something that companies that sell over the Internet are concerned about. We asked them whether enough is being done to protect Internet consumers against cybercrime. 62% said not enough. Only 15% said enough. So clearly in the minds of the average American consumer, they don't believe that they're getting adequate protection in terms of their communications on the Internet. Again, it's an inhibitor to the growth of electronic commerce. What we're trying to do, therefore, as an industry, is to focus on privacy in terms of the policy notification, giving personal control to the consumers through data empowerment tools such as P3P, and allow automation of privacy preferences. What we really need to do is to focus more on information security. I think much more energy should be placed on information security rather than on this debate about should we or shouldn't we have federal privacy legislation. What do I mean in the information security area? And I think a lot of this dovetails to some of the things that Pete just covered. First of all, awareness. I can't remember what you called your customer, stupid. The whole idea is we have not done enough to educate anybody about security. When you first start at your new job, you walk in, the IT, the MIS director sits down, explains to you how the network works, explains to you all the software, etc., and then he or she might spend 5 seconds talking about security, and that's it. Unless you're really one of these organizations getting hammered all the time, like Microsoft with 10,000 intrusions a day, you're probably not paying enough attention. Information sharing. ITAA has worked with many companies, including Microsoft and 18 other companies, to establish the information sharing analysis center. This was set up in January of this year, announced at the Department of Commerce with former Secretary of Commerce Norm Mineta. It's 19 of the largest companies in the world trying to figure out how they can better share information, not so much to respond to attacks when they've already occurred, but how they can help prevent more attacks. And also, they can cooperate more closely with law enforcement, with attorneys general, with federal law enforcement officials to share information back and forth. More education and training. The marketplace needs to be trained. Again, people don't focus on security. Best practices.
Pete talked about the absence of standards. Even when there are best practices, they are not used commonly. Too many people give away their passwords, break down their own security systems. Research and development, there simply is not being much spent these days on R&D. The Clinton administration proposed some federal funding of R&D. It was not approved by Congress, but I think it's something that needs to be revisited. Certainly the companies are spending a ton of money on R&D, the information security firms as well as the more traditional software firms. But most of that of necessity is short term. We need to look at longer term R&D. Advocacy. We do need to have strengthened information security laws. My International Association, WICSA, did a survey last year in conjunction with an organization called McConnell International, headed up by Bruce McConnell, the former head of the International Y2K Center, looking at information security laws around the world. It was a pretty sad story. It became very evident, of course, with the Philippines case. You all remember the Isle of You virus? They caught the guy who did it, but there were no laws on the books in the Philippines to prosecute him. Now, to the Philippines' credit, they then passed a whole series of laws which make them now a model country. But too many countries around the world simply do not have laws in place, and we need to move forward. An international outreach, again, this has to be an international solution because the challenge is global. We also did a survey, and I won't go through the details because I want to get run out of time, to also find out what people think about government. We found in the survey the same level of concern that people are not getting out of control of information they provide to government, and that's another inhibitor, this time not so much to e-commerce, but to e-government. So we need to empower consumers, we need to build information security as a fundamental aspect of the Internet, and we need more active engagement of government and industry. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Harrison. You mentioned cooperation with the Attorney General. Your cooperation with me when I stood up to winding up there was greatly appreciated. Our next speaker is Kelly Shanahan, and Kelly is from Wainwright Bank and Trust Company, which is generally considered to be one of the most socially progressive financial institutions in the country. She's the web development officer there, in charge of all their internet and web operations. And one of those operations is called communityroom.net. And it's a free website for nonprofits, including giving them the opportunity to have the visitors to the site contribute online to the nonprofit. In addition to doing all these good work, she has one more great quality. She's an Iowa native. Kelly?
Thank you. No. Let's see if I can get myself set up here. A little technical. Let's see. Okay, you need some technical expertise here. Good afternoon. I'm glad to be here with a fellow Iowan, Tom Miller. I was glad to hear he would be our moderator. Thank you for inviting me to speak about security access and privacy issues facing community banks as we deliver our products online on the Internet. Trust is a part of every bank's identity and plays a significant role in success or failure in their Internet initiatives. According to the American Heritage Dictionary, trust means the confidence in the integrity, ability, character, and truth of a person or thing. Trust builds accountability and legitimacy into virtual reality. Different from other dot-com organizations, a breach in trust or security at any financial institution would most likely have serious implications to the bottom line or the ongoing success of their Internet endeavors. The FDIC is a partner and plays a large role in ensuring the security in every bank's electronic initiatives. I'm sure you've heard a banker or two complain about audits, the FDIC, FDIC compliance, etc. But they are an institution that makes us perform at a very high level to ensure consumer privacy and safety. Outside of banking, you use words like security and privacy. Inside banking, we use the word safety and soundness and compliance. Safety and soundness refers to the physical security, procedural and process security, and business processes, while compliance includes privacy issues, namely adhering to the rules and regulations that monitor, ensure, and regulate consumers' rights. In the year 2000, Wainwright Bank had two major web initiatives, the launch of online banking in July 2000 and the launch of communityroom.net in September. Before that, we just had a website that was mainly an online brochure describing the products we offered as well as providing rates for our consumer deposit loan products. Our online banking services were provided by a third-party electronic banking vendor, while CommunityRoom.net was developed internally as a web portal for nonprofits to take donations online. The FDIC visited us in March, and with their help, we ensured that we would deliver our e-products securely while ensuring the customer's privacy. Whether you develop your e-products in-house or have a vendor supplying the services, it's a bank's responsibility to ensure that we deliver the products and services in a secure environment and does not compromise consumer rights. To guarantee consumer privacy on the Internet, not only do you have to have a comprehensive privacy policy, but you require adequate physical security as well as procedural process security. Your privacy policy won't mean anything if someone can hack into your website or your network and steal sensitive information. Procuring a safe, sound physical environment for web hosting is difficult because technology is always changing and evolving. If you have a promotional or for sure type website, your security needs to be nominal. But if you have a website where you exchange information, such as have a visitor fill an online form or an application, or give the ability for a visitor to send you email that may contain sensitive information, like an account number, your security must increase to protect the integrity of that non-public information that is exchanged. Concurrently, if you have a fully transactional website where you are conducting transactions via credit card or account transfer, or visitors have the ability to conduct online account inquiries, then you need a fully secure web hosting environment. Fulfilling those needs is no easy task. First, you need to determine if your organization has the resources to support a web host server in-house 24/7, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If not, then you need to find a vendor who can at a reasonable cost. What we found that worked extremely well was working with a professional security advisor to develop a web hosting questionnaire where we asked very detailed questions and received answers in writing. This tool went a long way in helping us determine the best and most secure web hosting environment for our organization. You could easily see which vendor really had the superior service. We had been using one of the leading national web hosting service providers, and we broke our contract and we changed service providers. What I found in doing research is that usually the web host service providers want each box or server uniform and will therefore not allow you to have it configured to your needs or have changes that are different than the other servers in their environment. Uniformity reduces their costs, but has a high probability of increasing your costs because of a breach in security. The would-be hacker just needs to penetrate the network and finds every box configured the same. It wouldn't take much initiative to bring down all the servers. Most likely, you will need a database server if you are doing any sort of exchange of information. A database server will most likely hold non-public information and therefore needs to be protected not only behind a firewall, but with encryption technology as well. Credit card or merchant processors now require you to encrypt data as part of their legal agreement. You need to use encryption technology to protect the information that is exchanged through email, online forms, account applications, account inquiries, credit card registration, and transactions. Secure Socket Layer, or SSL protocol, is used for the encrypted transfer of the data between the server and the client, or the web host server and the visitor's PC. Once a secure channel is established, encrypted data can be exchanged with ease and confidence. The secure environment is denoted on screen to the visitor in a couple of ways. Their address should be HTTPS rather than HTTP, and you'll see a small padlock in the lower right-hand corner of your screen in the status bar. SSL also allows you to use other digital certificates from certificate authorities such as VeriSign. A digital certificate further encrypts data, decreasing the probability of anyone being able to decrypt any captured data. All of the above, the web host server, the database server, and the encryption technology they use should sit behind the firewall to protect your website from the outside and would-be hackers, but allowing visitors to come to your site and conduct their business with ease. When doing your due diligence for web hosting, you need to make sure that you can change the rules for your firewall in a timely manner and that the firewall is monitored 24/7. Procedural process security is developing standard operating procedures as a process of checks and balances. The FDIC is very big on this. Areas where bias might influence decision making are identified and negated by separation of duties. The jobs of gathering the information, processing the information, and monitoring the information are all done by separate, different groups and mechanisms within an organization. Standard operating procedures that employ this system of checks and balances significantly reduces the probability that information can be mishandled or tampered in any way. Banks have historically used these types of procedures, but I have rarely seen them employed elsewhere in other industries. I'm sure you're all aware of the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, providing a mechanism to give customers the choice to prevent their bank from sharing their vital financial information. The Act requires clear and conspicuous notice of your privacy policy that details the collection, the disclosure of non-public personal information to affiliates and third parties or non-affiliates, and the limited ability for consumers to opt out of third-party sharing of this information. How does the bank comply? First, identify what information is shared with whom. Then, to develop your privacy policy, you must first ask the following questions for each item on the inventory. Why are we sharing this information? Do we want or have to provide the opt-out? Does the benefit outweigh the cost? How to contact your organization should be easy to find on your website and should include an email address, postal address, telephone number, and fax number. And by the way, these contact methods should all be manned with real life people. The future holds some interesting developments. In our very near future, we have the Electronic Signatures and Global and National Commerce Act. Optional March 3rd, but mandatory by October 1st. This act affects every bank transmitting information to consumers electronically via website, email, internet banking, or dial-up banking, and will allow digital signatures to be used on the internet to authenticate identity. Also, banks must be able to establish procedures to negotiate and totally electronic communication as well as transactions. Also, execution of contracts via electronic delivery of legal documents, for example, completing a mortgage agreement requires that the bank, attorney, county offices all deliver documents electronically. It's not very far away. ATMs already have the capability to be connected to the internet and will unify a bank's delivery of services. But what I wish for the future in this arena is that computers and technology evolve as automobiles have. You don't have to read the owner's manual to drive a new car or your friend's vehicle. They are all standardized to the point where they're safe and secure, and they all work basically the same way, but they come in all different shapes, sizes, and colors, whatever your choice may be. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Our fourth speaker, our last speaker, is Tony Hadley. Tony is the Director of Government Affairs for Experian, and that's a company that has one of the largest databases in the country. Everything from consumer credit reports to voters lists for political campaigns. If you need information, if you need data, it's Tony's company. Tony has also been very active in some of the organizations that we deal with from time to time in terms of committee memberships and other positions, including the Direct Marketers Association. He's also involved with the United States Chamber of Commerce on various committees. So Tony, welcome, and we're pleased to have you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. I wanted to address the issue of access today. That's a simple one, and I see that it's up to me to do that. It's a complicated issue, probably one of the most complex issues of all of the fair information practices. What I want to do is discuss the how, when, and where of access, because you might be surprised to learn that Experian believes in access for certain types of information, and we have gone through a deliberate corporate strategy, and we have a very well-articulated rationale for when we do provide access and when we don't. And I hope that you understand that better once I'm finished. Now, many of you know Experian is one of the large credit reporting agencies, but over the last few years since our spinoff from TRW Corporation, we've merged with other information-based companies, and while we're largely invisible to many consumers, it might interest you to know that we probably touch consumers' lives on a daily basis. For example, we help underwrite the risks associated with point-of-sale transactions for credit, telecommunications and other utilities and services. We had reduced financial fraud by comparing credit applications across widespread databases. One in four pieces of mail that you receive every day has been touched by an Experian database. And we enter ourselves in 15% of all commercial mail from our sites in Iowa, New York, Dallas, Texas, and Lincoln, Nebraska. Experian operates as a third-party website operator on some of the largest and most popular websites to verify name and address and identities. We help authenticate individuals for e-signatures and digital signatures. In the very near future, we will verify and authenticate your access to medical records under HIPAA, and perhaps even in internet voting in the near future. And of course, our data is used to enhance public safety. We were just recently involved in Firestone recall, and more you'll see us involved in the actions and activities that take place on toll roads, and that is just providing state DMVs information for billing purposes as you go through the express lane. So we collect a lot of information, and we think we collect it and use it to consumers' benefit by expanding their choices and opportunities. We operate under 11 specific federal laws and a panoply of state laws. We're no stranger to regulation or law, and we never take the attitude that no law is necessary. We do say law should be right. It should be targeted to the right specific problem, and we are very, very concerned about the inadvertent consequences of ill-conceived law. So we're going to be right with you working on all of your proposals, and we're going to tell you when we don't think it's right, and we're going to agree with you when we think you have. In the online space, we haven't seen a law that we think is right yet. We don't believe that there's been enough debate, enough clarity brought to the issue, and for that reason, we do not support online legislation at the federal or state level right now, although I suspect that it won't be long before we can agree on some aspects of the fair information practices. Why is access necessary? Well, of course, one of the reasons it's necessary, or one of the reasons it's debated, is because it's one of the fair information practices. Notice, choice, access, security, enforcement, they roll off the tongue, don't they? But what is access? Now, I've seen some proposals that say you should get reasonable access to consumer information. What is reasonable access? We don't know yet. We're trying to come up with that. Of course, FTC has looked at the issue of access, and they came to very few conclusions as to whether it should be provided for certain information or whether it shouldn't. Have really left open the question of access. They have certainly exposed a lot of the issues associated with access, and we think it was a good exercise. But for Experian's point of view, we believe that access is necessary for accuracy and accountability. So we say access is necessary when data is used for substantive decision making, that is to make a decision about you that could affect your life, your credit, your employment, insurance. When data is retrieved to create an individual profile, that's when you should have access. And when consumers request for access can actually be authenticated. Those are the benchmarks we choose as a company to decide when we're going to provide access to individuals to their data. So that what that means for the type of information that Experian has is that we provide access for consumer reporting and all applications under the federal and state FCRAs, but we say no for marketing data. But with that caveat, we also say that many consumers have far more access to even that kind of data than they believe. That is, there isn't a single organization that a person is a customer of that you can't call and get limited information about yourself from them, such as name, address, contact, probably limited transactional information, balance, account information, what they bought recently. That is a customer service that many, many catalogers, retailers, financial services, people dealing in the commercial world provide access almost on a daily basis upon request. No legal requirement that they do it, but it's good customer service. What does access mean? Does it mean a full file disclosure, such as the FCRA, where we must disclose everything we have about that person, no matter what database it resides in? Does it just mean disclosure, or does it mean the right to correct and edit? What happens when you have multiple affiliates and multiple databases for affiliates? What happens when you're like Experian and you have to keep information in separate databases for legal compliance or auditing? For example, we don't combine our marketing databases with our credit reporting databases because that would be a violation of federal and state law. We don't combine our information on DMV, we purchase DMV information from every state. We don't combine that with either marketing or credit because law won't allow us. And contracts with the DMV won't allow us to combine that information, nor will they allow us to provide access to that information. What happens if you have these disparate and separate databases for good reason, both legal and in compliance with your own self-regulatory values about information, and something happens where you're required to provide a full file access? How would we build a system architecture to disclose everything we have about individuals? Now, we keep information on 220 million Americans' credit profiles. We keep marketing information on 98% of American households. And we have DMV information about everyone that has an automobile. We have information on everyone that votes, and we use that in compliance with state laws and provide that information to candidates and political parties. We do analysis on that. Let candidates and political parties better understand people who vote for them or who they want to vote for them. So, on a very real scale, is full file disclosure of a database like Experience really wanted and necessary? We don't keep consumer profiles on people except in credit. It's the only consumer profile we keep. It's keyed to the name, to that identity. The rest of it is householded or kept in separate databases. What do we want access to? Do we want it to just contact information like name, address, telephone number, and other information that will allow a third party to contact you? Do we want it for self-reported information that has been provided to us affirmatively, let's say in an opt-in mode, on surveys and product registration? Do we want access to detailed, granular, transactional information that may exist in databases? What about government records? Should somebody have access to the government records that we've acquired and be able to alter, delete, correct those? What about summarized census information that describes your household, your tract, your census tract, the type of characteristics you probably have because of who you live around, information, access to that information? What about proprietary information like modeled and scored behavior? That's the conclusions that Experian has made about you based upon the type of information you have. Is this the type of access we have? Now, I'm not suggesting that it is or not. I'm saying those are the questions you should be asking yourself when you put forward a proposal that says you should provide reasonable access to the information you have. One of the most difficult issues associated with access is authenticating a person's request for it. Now, there are several levels of verification and authentication that Experian can apply to an access request, and it's most easy to do it in consumer credit reporting because we have all of the information that is necessary to say that you are Tony Hadley and no one else. We have your name, we have your address, employer, date of birth, social security number, past addresses. That would be kind of a level two. I'd skip level one, which would just be your name and address verification. That there's a reasonable sense that Tony Hadley is who he said he is because he's given us an address that matches our database. The level two would be what I just talked about. The third one would be the real authentication for a consumer report. That is, you get it and no one else. And that is all of the identifying information I just said, plus your ability to answer some questions that only you and Experian know about yourself, based upon your credit history or other balances and types of credit information you have. So there are different levels of verification and authentication. And we cannot authenticate individuals' requests to access to their marketing data. Why? Because marketing data doesn't include Social Security numbers. It doesn't include employers. It doesn't include finite information that would allow us to identify you. At best, it includes name and address, perhaps your telephone number, always your telephone number. Your date of birth is probably estimated, or it's, at least it has not been confirmed by us. It's probably self-reported. We don't have the information that would allow us to say, Tony Hadley's requesting his information, and it only goes to him. It's the kind of information that your neighbor could very well have. Census information, self-reported information about your purchases. People know these kinds of things. That's why we haven't chosen to provide access to marketing data. And that's why we can't, unless it's the wish of policymakers to require us to put the kind of finite, granular, identifying information in our marketing records that we keep in our consumer reporting records. And I would maintain that that is something you don't want, it's something Experian doesn't want, and it's something consumers don't want. They don't want another database of a consumer profile on them. They don't want the fear that their marketing data could be used for more identity assumptions. They don't want or fear the idea of
Tony,
marketing
data. Am I right in thinking you're winding up here?
I am winding up. That people could use that information for snoopery. So what I would like to say is that while we don't want to provide access to marketing data, that doesn't mean that we're not sensitive to people's points of view about that. We want to provide people a robust notice of what information we do collect and give them an opportunity to say, no, I don't want my marketing information used or shared with third parties.
Okay, here you Thank go. You, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
Quick question to Tony. Should consumers have access to data that they supplied?
It depends on what the information is being used for. If the information is used to simply make a judgment or an assumption about a solicitation that you may or may not be interested in receiving, the answer is no, because that's not a quality life judgment about you. It's not a substantive decision as to whether you're going to receive a solicitation or not. If it's information that is used for underwriting, yes, they should.
Okay. Harris, do I understand you right? Were you saying that when people say they're concerned about privacy, it's really security. It's not things like supplying information for marketing purposes.
That seems to be the sense of our survey, General Miller, that most of the people are very much concerned about data being misused, particularly financial information and credit card information. But I think most people seem to understand that, in fact, it is a marketing world, and that's where the data are going to be used for marketing. For some, of course, people on the extreme who never want to have their information used for anything, and certainly there should be a provision that would allow that, but that doesn't seem to be the highest priority based on our survey work.
I just disagree. I think they're concerned about both. Let me cite you an example. U.S. Bank up in Minneapolis went into a marketing project with a third party in a contract. I think they shared in some of the proceeds. There was an outroar. There was an absolute outroar. The company backed off of what they were doing. They paid money out. That wasn't security. Are those Minnesota consumers different than the rest of the country?
Was this financial information that was being used for marketing purposes? We do agree that I did single out children online privacy, health information, and financial information. Those are areas where we do agree that people are very concerned about it, and that blends into the concerns about security. What I'm talking about is basic information about consumer preference.
Financial information. Well, how do you explain the DoubleClick controversy then?
The DoubleClick controversy, to my mind, was not really a controversy. It was really just a few privacy advocates raising it. I didn't see any great outcry in the American public opinion polls. We looked at all the polls that came out at that time. We couldn't find any information that indicated people were concerned about it. there is a concern that, again, about being able to access information that can be used to undermine your own personal safety or your personal credit rating or your health insurance, those kinds of things. And I think we're exactly the same place Tony is on that. But to basically say, I went into Nordstrom's last week and bought a sweater, or I ordered something from Nordstrom's over the telephone, or I ordered Nordstrom's online, and Nordstrom's can't use that information to market to me, we can't find any consumers who have that point of view.
Well, let me just suffice to say on the double prick, some attorney generals see American public opinion and reaction differently than you do.
We understand. That's why you have a different policy position than we do.
That's right. Any questions or comments from the audience? Yes.
Right, and we would say that they have the right to opt out of those emails, and we would actually support law that gives them that right.
But
that is a problem.
Other questions or comments? Yes.
Yeah, the restrictions come to us from under the Census Confidentiality Act, and that is any information we get from the Census Bureau on a 10-year period or updated period is stripped of personally identifiable information. But it is identifiable down to the ZIP plus 4 level, which allows us to presume certain characteristics about an individual. They're presumptions. They're not accurate depictions of that individual. But if you live in 22031 zip code of Fairfax, Virginia, you are probably in your 40s. You probably have at least two children. You probably drive a Volvo. You probably have children in college. Your income is probably between $75,000 and $100,000. Those are summarized.
And how do they vote? And how do they vote?
Well,
you don't have to answer that. You don't have to answer that. Tony, we'll give you the last word here. I think we have to move on. But Kelly, Harris, Tony, and Pete, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
You're
welcome.
Janet, are you next here?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for doing it.
Thank you,
Mr. Paul.
Thanks for doing this.
Oh, you're welcome.
Tony, thanks for doing this.
Kelly,
thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thanks for seeing you again. So, Martin said hello.
Is there a restraint here?
Sure. No, I think it's supposed to start right away. But,
okay.
Okay.
You pick up for dinner tonight?
Oh, I'll stand up here. So it's not just break from sitting. You know, we're gonna call it first. Do you want to start out? Or?
Hi, Chris Milliken. We've only emailed.
Hi. Yes. Thank you,
person. Yeah.
Yes.
Well,
Okay. Yeah, how come you didn't bid on a state of Arizona employee healthcare?
Now, and you also know who's being read.
Right there, that's
it.
How did you know that was him?
Yeah. I just put a what do you think I need to do? I just want to make sure that I don't mess up anything delicate.
Goodbye, Wainwright Mag.
Yeah.
No, I haven't. It's a lovely room. The seats are uncomfortable, yeah. I was sitting on a swivel seat today. I'm very stylish. This room. Frank? I'm trying to figure out the last result from the turn of the century, 1920, 1910. Yeah, that's what I was saying. It's almost prairie style. And the big fireplace with all the stone around it. Yeah, I'm on the fly in, fly out schedule. I know what that's like. I've got another speaking engagement coming up, and then we have several projects that were tied to the effective date of the privacy reg. So now the clock's running on those, and I need to get them done. Now, we're doing a...
I don't think there's any realistic shot at getting the marketing extension in private.
Well, I don't think they're going to get that. We'll accomplish that through HHS. He's already indicated he doesn't want to touch it. Well, the thing is, well, I think they can, I looked into that, and I think that they can say that there was adequate notice. We didn't comment on it. It was not on our radar screen. So we went back and looked at it, and I think they said enough that they could probably tweak through. But there has been a lot of noise on Capitol Hill about that issue. I think Congress can't pass anything these days, I think. But on that issue, it seemed like it was isolated enough that they might be able to move on it.
The AG sent a letter to HHS, 36 of us, asking that the regs go ahead and be implemented. That the HHS look at the marketing. We do that.
Well, it's just...
Yeah. Do you want to announce it to Mr. Lane? Huh? Okay.
This is your 2-minute warning.
I don't know how we can detail you went into the marketing provisions, but when you really, if you read through all the regs and start seeing how they actually work, it's horrible.
because you know for certain you can't.
Have you seen a copy of our letter on that?
I think I have.
It actually may be at the
board. Tell me that's where. Yeah, but. I would have a hard time telling you who we met with. We met 50 from
the state.
Some of them were from some government office, some consumer groups.
I'm shocked. So I was talking to people at dinner, and they said, you know, like, one of the issues, of course, that we've covered, and there's a category of small employers under 30 who self-administer. Because we really, we usually do this little thing about why health information is not quite privacy is important. Anyone who has it. I thought that might be a mistake. It's why I get the nuts and bolts of why we're going. And they were really interested in the new in the world. I have a PowerPoint.
Could you email it to your forum?
I will probably have to send you it on zip. I'll give it to you in hard copy.
Hard copy.
Okay, I can get the hard copy.
Let me ask people, please, to take your seats so we can begin.
Hey, Joy. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Welcome back. Welcome back to our website audience. This is a panel that is going to be focusing on medical privacy. And just by way of introducing the subject vis-a-vis NAG, about 36 attorneys general sent a letter to Secretary Thompson a few weeks ago asking that the HIPAA regulations go ahead and be put into effect, but paying attention and expressing concern about the so-called marketing exemption or exception to those regulations, that should be looked at. Medical privacy is something that I think in every state and in virtually every focus group people raise as something they consider to be personal and private information. But once you get beyond that, the devil, as we've learned in virtually every session today, the devil is in the details. We're privileged today to have three speakers, and the way we're going to do this is I've asked each speaker to take about 10 minutes. We're going to start with Dr. Reed Tuckson, who's Senior Vice President of Consumer Health and Medical Care Advancement at United Health Group, to talk about, from an implementation perspective, what are some of the issues involving medical records privacy. Next, we'll turn to Joy Pritz, who's Senior Counsel at the Georgetown University Health Project, to talk about what is going on federally now with respect to medical privacy and in some of the states. And we're going to finish up with Professor Zittrain, who is going to fill in the gaps as he sees them. If I might, turn it over to Dr. Tuckson.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. In my 10 minutes, I want to make 4 points with you. First, the current health delivery system is dependent on the complex interplay between science, technology, organizations, a variety of stakeholders, expectations, and of course, of data. Number two, that public expectations for the future increasingly demand even greater dependency on the intelligent use of data and new internet-based information dissemination systems. Point three, there are a long history of ethical foundations that now are in the process of being updated that must inform healthcare delivery in this new internet information age. And fourth, a sustained and informed public discourse is necessary to define the balance between the regulation and organizational accountability that addresses the essential questions of quality of healthcare, privacy, confidentiality, and the preservation of individual human dignity. Well, this system really is very connected to the interplay of data. Science, technology, research, of course, the work of health professionals and health institutions, the interests of patients, and of course, increasingly, performance measurement, outcome measurement, and accountability to regulatory organizations are highly dependent on the simultaneous back and forth exchange of increasingly sophisticated and detailed data. For those of us that work at the health plan level, we find ourselves very much in the middle of this mosaic, pulling and coordinating pieces together. In fact, as United Health Group, as an example of one of the more modern of these companies, our mission is to improve the health and well-being of individuals at all stages of life by enabling, coordinating, and facilitating care. We are not just a managed care company, and that's one of the easy luxuries that people sometimes have when they think about healthcare organizations today. We are a company called United Healthcare that does serve 8.5 million people in almost every state, but we're also a company called Unipryse, serving 8 million people in 260 of the largest companies in America. We are Ovations, the company that provides the health services for the American Association of Retired Persons and all those millions of people throughout the nation, providing care coordination for frail elderly. We are also Ingenix, knowledge, research, data, information analysis tools. And finally, we are a group of companies called Specialized Care that provide everything from a network for transplantation and complex oncology and cardiac surgery to vision, dental, behavioral, and a service that provides 24-hour, 7 days a week coordinated case management services for people through the telephone, together touching over 40 million lives in every state. And that's important for points I will make at the end. Coordinating care for 15 million people, over 350,000 physicians now, and we've processed, as a result of doing all that, over 2 terabytes of information. This enables us to process 190 claims transactions efficiently, but also important, processing and evaluating the credentials and performance of health professionals and institutions, making sure that the public is well protected, supporting and coordinating the decisions made by patients and their physicians, enhancing the scientific basis of health and medical practice, and protecting the health of the public. Well, that's fine. We've been doing those things. But now the public is saying we want more. The recent Institute of Medicine had 2 reports that gained great traction throughout the society. One is called The Error is Human. You remember that. It talked about the number of errors in medicine, and now the newest one called Crossing the Chasm. And the point that he essentially makes is the system in this country is still too fragmented. The people that participate operate as silos. It doesn't translate knowledge into practice. It has unnecessary duplication and waste. Safety is not an essential feature. We need new continuous healing relationships to provide care outside of the narrow confines of face-to-face interactions. And people must have choices so they can meaningfully participate in the decisions that affect them. Well, we believe that that makes sense, and we are giving you, let me give you 3 quick examples of how this works in the real world today. First, care coordination, facilitating the physician's course of treatment. We use aggregate data and analyze that to identify criteria that tells us where you ought to have high sensitivity for intervening. We then are able to take information about patients, and when they meet those profiles, those alarm bells, are able to get involved in pre-event education, admission counseling, inpatient care advocacy, discharge planning, and readmission prevention, taking high-risk people and getting them intensive 24-hour interactions. internet facilitation to that enhances continuous healing relationships, and particularly around things like information on drugs, what a patient is taking. What you find now is that a person has many different care providers. They don't know what the person is taking, particularly they may not know what over-the-counter medicine. If you can have a system where the patient updates that information, puts it on record, let this doctor and that doctor and that doctor know all the things that they're on, let a system kick into place when there are incompatibilities, dangers, misadventures ahead, those are things that benefit all. Physician data sharing, taking information about physicians' practice and giving it back to them individually, allowing them to change their behavior, to continue to have continuous learning. And then thirdly, trying to reduce some of the costs. We are aware that all across this country, physicians want to get paid simpler, easier, on time, without hassles, predictably. They send their information now to a number of intermediaries. Then we get it late in the process, costs everybody money, lots of hassles. The internet system is what ultimately will create the enormous efficiencies that will address those issues. Better quality data leads to improved care. More complete, accurate, and timely data is the most useful. Consumers will have more control over access and choice with relevant information given at the moment they need it. Analysis and modeling of patients facilitates the anticipation of care needs, interventions and costs. Tracking patient care and compliance allows us to focus and have early intervention. Clinical data allows us to promote evidence-based medicine, best practice, and consistency in care delivery. And then finally, efficient use of healthcare assets takes waste and administrative hassle out of the system. Well, there are relevant ethical foundations that must inform this new era of healthcare delivery. The Ethical Force program of the American Medical Association's Independent Ethics Institute taught us that there are important criteria which we think make a lot of sense. Transparency regarding collection and storage. Whenever feasible, informed consent. And when informed consent is not, there must be formal processes to authorize waiver. Limit collection to explicitly defined needs. Security appropriate to the sensitivity. Access by individuals so that they can amend, append their information. After all, it is theirs. Identifiable data quality should assure accuracy and completeness, limitation on use to explicit purposes, and the trustees of this information must be accountable. Well, at the end of the day, as our moderator has said, the devil is in the details. This is a complex interplay. There must be a sustained and informed public discourse, which we want very much to participate in, that defines the balance between regulation and organizational accountability. We support HIPAA. We are underway with our compliance now. We support GLB. Contractual provisions for the subscribers and members are made explicit. We will continue to do even more. Privacy notices on our website, strict protections and technical measures for managing confidential information, and chain of trust agreements that we have with our contractors and agents and our business departments. We, at the end of the day, and in summary, appreciate the legitimate role for regulation and for public assurance. If patients do not believe that that their information will be safe, they will not, in fact, disclose. And that is going to be very frightening in terms of the ability to give them the kind of care they expect. And we know that physicians and other participants will not participate in the coordination that the IOM report is so zealous in calling for. What we are concerned about is finding the balance between state, federal regulation and oversight and efficient, accountable, and ethical conduct of a complex venture operated in the public good. This is the delicate dance that we are all engaged in. And I will conclude to say that what we essentially do want to emphasize is an importance of standardization of safeguards across the states to allow interstate exchange of data that facilitates administrative simplification, and well-intended rules should not disrupt the flow of protected data that improves the health of the public and creates efficiencies that reduce costs. How then do we find not the arguments and the tensions, but how do we collectively use our different points of view to create the synergy between individual privacy concerns, enhanced care coordination, support for health professionals, public health protection, new clinical knowledge, and cost and fraud reduction that ultimately leads to the intelligent and responsible use of Internet-based health information. We look forward to having opportunities to continue the discourse with you today and after this session is over. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I have the pleasure today of summarizing the status of state health privacy laws and the federal regulation to you in 10 easy minutes. So I'm going to be speaking like that guy in the Federal Express commercial, and if you take me, you can play it back in slow motion later. I'd like to start first by talking about what is going on, what the status of state health privacy laws is, what we expect it to be, and changes to be made in the next year or so, and how that interacts with the new federal health privacy regulation. I think a really important concept in discussing the state's role in regulating health privacy is to recognize the fact that this is an area that the states have traditionally regulated in. Healthcare has been a traditional area where states have governed, and they have also governed the attachment of the information that's related to that healthcare. Unfortunately, the states have not kept up in general with the advances in information technology and in advances in healthcare that have come about in the last 20 years, particularly with the new managed care where health information is shared with a lot of different persons and organizations. And the result of this is that you have only a few states that have really enacted what we would call comprehensive health privacy laws, where they try to look at the entire universe of who might be using healthcare information and how they might be using it and to impose some regulation on that. Instead, what you have in the vast majority of states is a patchwork of regulation where when an issue has come up, then the state addresses it. And you can really see this when you review all 50 states, which I've had the pleasure of doing, because they range from states where there is almost very de minimis protection for people's health information to states at the absolute opposite end of the continuum where they try to address every single concern. The result of this is you get a wide variety in health protections for citizens in just adjoining states. This state might have protections and say doctors, hospitals, and employers can't disclose health information, and the neighboring state may have nothing in place. If you're interested in all the details of this, you can go to our, if you want the full version versus the Cliff Notes version of what is going on at the state level, you can go to our website, which is www.healthprivacy.org. At that website, we do have a summary of all 50 state major health privacy laws. It was drafted in 1999. We have just received some funding to start an update of that, and so we will be working on that within the next couple months. But it is interesting to see how much things vary, not only from state to state, but also just even within a given state. Because the issues are addressed on a case-by-case basis, you'll get regulation of HMOs, you'll get regulation dealing with HIV/AIDS-specific information. Coming into this, some states have decided that that is not the way to deal with this kind of sensitive information, and that it is time to look at the entire picture. And in the upcoming year, we expect some states, particularly, I believe, Vermont and New York, who have comprehensive legislation pending, to be trying to move those agendas forward. There are some additional states that are looking at more general health privacy laws. What you will see more of in the next 12 to, I would say, 18 months is a lot of state moving in three specific areas. And those areas are genetic information, health information that's related to domestic violence, and health information, which is a component of financial services information or financial information. The states are acting in all three instances under federal guidance, shall we say, that large carrot or stick, depending on how you look at it, that forces the states to act to comply either with HIPAA insurance provisions, not the privacy regulations, insurance provisions in the case of genetics and domestic violence, And in the case of financial information, it comes from the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. In all three circumstances, there is a tremendous pressure on the states to have action, either regulation or legislation, in the upcoming months. So you can expect a lot of movement there. You might ask, well, now that we have these federal privacy regulations in place, is it really necessary for the states to be engaging in this kind of behavior? Isn't this enough? Do we really need to act? And to the question of are the federal health privacy regulations enough, the answer is no. They're not enough. And is there room for the states to act? Yes, not only because of the scope of the federal regulations, but also the general preemption scheme within the regulation itself. The federal health privacy regulations, by virtue of language that's in HIPAA itself, do not preempt state law that is more stringent. That's defined as being a state law that, in the case of an individual who wants to have access to the health information, provides a greater access right or a right to amend that information. In the case of use or disclosure of that information, the state law will be more stringent if it provides more restrictions on the uses or disclosures. So if a state decides that it wants to afford higher protections, it can do that. And this is not a grandfather type provision, which was in some of the proposed health privacy legislation. This is a provision that will remain in effect even after the regulation has gone into effect, which it has. The states remain free to act in the future. I would love to take this opportunity to summarize what the federal health privacy rules do for you, but that just isn't possible given the time limits here. But what I would like to do is highlight some areas of concern with the federal health privacy rules. One of the largest areas that the federal health privacy rules lack, I would say, is that they really are not comprehensive rules. They're the largest set of health privacy rules we've ever seen from the federal government, and of course they are more comprehensive than anything that's on the books at this moment. But they aren't comprehensive. They govern only what we call a core set of institutions or organizations or people who hold health care information. Health plans, health care clearinghouses who will be transferring this information back and forth between plans and doctors, and a subset of healthcare providers. And it's only those healthcare providers who transmit health claims type information electronically. So, and I've heard this repeatedly, well, that encompasses most doctors and healthcare providers. In reality, that is a very large gap in the rule, because if you were, for example, to go to a doctor who is hired by an employer, that doctor, it would not be governed by these regulations. That's because that doctor is paid by the employer. He's not going to file health claims type information, so he falls beyond the scope. So there's this whole area out here of people who hold health information, and it's only this core group that's really regulated directly. Right now, the way the regulation's written, it does cover a broad range of health information. As a matter of fact, if the information is held by a covered health care provider, chances are, if the information is identifiable, it's going to be covered. You should be aware of the fact, however, that there is pressure to change that, to revert back to what was in the proposed rules, which would not cover paper records. It would not cover health information which is in an oral format. So those pressures are there, and there is some pressure, some movement, or at least hopes for some movement, back to this narrower category of only covering electronic information. The other area in what is covered that is somewhat under attack is it's not just the format of the information, which is the paper or oral. It's the content of the information, and this is getting into one of those hair-splitting differences that only lawyers can love, and that is that there are some who have asserted that the regulations can only govern health information that is directly related to one of those health claims-type transactions. So if your doctor were to make a note in his record and he never sent that anywhere, and even though he kept it electronically on a computer, for instance, because it wasn't related to a health claims-type regulation, it wouldn't be covered by these regulations.
So those are some concerns about the scope of the regulation that I think you should be aware of. In addition to the scope, there are some other areas of the regulation that are problematic from the consumer's point of view, and there are other areas that are problematic from the covered entity's point of view, and I'll try to touch on those just very briefly. The consent provision is, which would require health care providers to get a patient's consent before they use health care information for treatment, payment, or health care operations, is not a favorite, and that's a gross understatement of the health care industry. They would really like to see that removed. The minimum necessary standard, which limits the type of information that can flow from those core groups to other groups and also how they can use that information, is another area where there is a lot of controversy. The comments that were filed in response to that rather strange notice and comment period there was after the final rule was issued indicates that there still is a lot of industry pressure to change that minimum necessary standard. One of the issues that's of major concern for a lot of states is the minors' rights issue, because right now the way the regulation is set up, it kind of tracks state law. It says that if a minor, that the general rule is that a parent has the right to control a minor's health care information. However, if the minor is allowed under state law to obtain medical procedures without the parental consent, it's the minor, not the parent, that has the right of control over that health information. This is one of the areas that was specifically mentioned in the press release by the Bush administration as being an area that they wanted to change. The marketing provision, from the opposite point of view, the marketing provision is an area where, of course, a lot of healthcare consumers would like to see some improvement. The marketing provision that is in the privacy regulation as it stands is not consumer protective, and in some ways is misleading, and we think it may be actually worse than no provision at all. Of equal concern for a lot of people in the states is the enforcement of these privacy regulations, because HHS has gone on the record as saying that they don't have adequate funding to enforce these regulations. Right now it's scheduled to be monitored out of a rather small office, the Office of Civil Rights. And we have been at presentations where they've told us that they intend to engage in triage. And so if you have Aunt Sally out in Idaho who's trying to get her medical records from her doctor and they haven't received 50 other complaints from that doctor, it's quite likely that Aunt Sally will never hear from the HHS and will not ever receive a remedy to her problem through this regulation. They simply do not have the staff to do it. We see this as an area where perhaps the states can step in. The net effect of this, when you lay the federal privacy regulation on top of state health privacy regulation, is that the federal regulation maintains a basic floor line, a baseline, a floor, if you will, for health privacy protections. In some states, this is very important because right now they're here, and the federal privacy regulations will move them up here. It does allow many states the states that have gone higher than that, to keep those laws in place. And unless you want to lower those laws, we think that it's important that the preemption scheme remain the way it is. Okay. The states can act to fill the gaps in the regulation and improve on on the weaknesses and engage in also in parallel enforcement. So there's plenty of room here for the states to act, even though we now have, we're hoping, a federal privacy regulation. Thank you.
Forgive me, I'm worried about getting long-haul flight syndrome, so I just wanted to walk around a little bit rather than sit or stand in one place. So I'm going to try to take the big view and to incorporate by reference everything I said this morning, so that has now been said again right now. You'll recall that I had a slide with a big orange blob on it, and I was tracing intellectual property protection over time and showing how there's a change in technology that changes people's behavior, enables things that couldn't be enabled before. The law comes in to try to interpose that vertical red line, and with mixed success, and ultimately, I conclude in the intellectual property realm, the key is to move the orange blob rightward again rather than just try to have this barrier. Now, if you weren't here for my morning talk, you have no idea what I'm talking about, but that's the price of not attending. So I think there are lessons here for privacy. And I think that because if you look at the history of privacy legislation, it's a very different story from intellectual property legislation. The privacy legislation we've seen is typically piecemeal. It's usually highly specific, thus the Video Rental Protection Act, making sure that no American is deprived of the right to control his or her information regarding what specific VHS videotapes he or she has rented. Of course, it doesn't protect it by genre. You can still let it be known that you like horror. It's just specific titles that are covered by the act. That's also known as the Judge Bork Protection Act. And the Driver's License Act, you know, it's this very piecemeal legislation. And it also reflects, I mean, we heard a serious reality coming from Harris Miller on the last panel. Harris Miller says, I know you all think privacy is a big deal, but trust me, I've run the numbers, I've paid poll takers a lot of money, and privacy is not a big deal. You can get people whipped up about it for about 10 minutes. So you can point to specific scandals. All right, Watergate, okay, that's a biggie, and as a result, we get the Privacy Act of 74 coming out of that because people were up in arms about Watergate. Interestingly, the Privacy Act of 74 was originally meant to cover all databases of information kept, public and private, and by the time it finished going through Congress, it was only covering government databases, not applying to private ones. And yes, we got the Video Rental Act after the Bork hearings, but again, it's highly specific stuff for which the motion on it is what I would like to term Aristotelian. It's the kind of thing where Aristotle thought that to keep the arrow moving, you had to constantly press it. Otherwise, it stops in place. There's got to be a force constantly pushing the thing, or it won't move. A sort of Sisyphean vision of what it takes to get privacy stuff done. If you're not constantly pushing it, it starts to erode away in a moment. And I think the history of it, in fact, the recent history especially, has really borne out the Aristotelian vision. Given that, given how hard it is even to get legislation through if one is a privacy advocate that is particularly attentive to the concerns one has, you might want to look to other solutions. When I look at the HHS regs, and I'm sure Joy Pritz and her group have done so much work on this stuff, and my guess, I can't speak for her, but my guess is they had a bit of dilemma as these regs came through. Because how did these regs even get started? Congress started with HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. The idea was to create Napster for medical records. That was the point of HIPAA. Because without it, you can't give people like Dr. Tuckson the data that they need in order to get the job done right and efficiently. There's all those intermediaries that Tuckson was pointing to. If I have one particular system on a mini computer running off of some operating system from 20 years ago that's maintaining the records and somebody else keeps them all on paper, if you want to communicate with each other, between doctors and insurance companies, between doctors and the government, it'd be nice to have a common standard. Call it MP3 for medical records. That's what we need, and seeing that the market wasn't about to come up with a solution, it was hard to organize everybody together to come up with a standard. It's a little bit more complicated than, all right, we all drive on the right side of the road. It's harder than that. We had the government pass HIPAA to try to do it. Now, as it was happening, there was realization that HIPAA was going to lead to trouble, potential trouble on the privacy front, because the orange blob would grow. Once you Napsterize the medical records, the opportunities to put them to ancillary uses, to be able to send somebody a birthday card for their new child because you know when they entered the maternity ward and you can just generate that list, send it off to Procter & Gamble, and away you go, the opportunities become much more manifest. Congress promised itself and crossed its fingers and said, we will pass privacy legislation, and if we don't, one, shame on us, and two, let's let HHS do it. So they set themselves a deadline. They didn't pass legislation, and it fell into HHS's lap. And if you read the preamble to HHS's regs, you see them troubled by the fact that it was really left in their laps. They say, we would love to see a private right of action so that that person in Idaho can get a lawyer on contingency who can sue the socks off somebody that isn't giving her what she is due under her rights. But HHS says we can't do it. You know, it's just beyond our jurisdiction to offer a private right of action. You see them also quite explicitly saying that they don't think they have the staff to handle any complaints there might be and have a strategy of informal dispute resolution. You know, call up the company, see if it can be worked out. Now, in many instances, that's perfectly good, but if you really want to get serious about privacy, put some teeth in it, that's not exactly necessarily the strategy you'd want to take. All right, so I'm highlighting some of the deficiencies here. In what very little time I have left, let me just square the circle on borrowing from what I believe the publishers, the music companies, have learned from their bout with the Napsterization of their data. And what they've learned is, even when you've basically got Congress ready to write you a blank check, you know, hand us the legislation and we'll pass it, there are limits to what you can accomplish. That's why they're leaning towards the technology as a means of protecting it. And I think, especially given this Aristotelian problem with privacy legislation, if we can use the opportunity that is currently unfolding to sit everybody down and create standards for standardization of records themselves. That's the first stage of HIPAA. That's what's unfolding now. If we add to that the goal of creating privacy standards latent in the software, then we might get some Newtonian kind of enforcement. Because once you build the software, it's awfully hard to change it. So this is concrete being poured. We could pour it in a way that says, all right, instead of, for example, I'll take from the HIPAA regs, you have this right of audit. You can check out your own records if you want. How is that right exemplified right now? Well, we can look to some of the states, because some states have this right already written into their law. So, for instance, here in Massachusetts, there's the Medical Information Bureau that maintains data on something like 75 million Americans. I know that's more people than there are in Massachusetts. They've gone beyond their bounds a little bit, jurisdictionally speaking. But they maintain this data to protect against insurance fraud. So if you come up to a company and you're talking about, oh no, I've had no heart trouble, they can check with the MIB and see if in fact you have not had any heart trouble. So I wrote the MIB because I'm allowed to ask them for my records, and I said, I'd like to see my records, please. And 6 to 8 weeks later, I got a letter that said, yep, we have nothing on you. And I wanted to write them back and say, did you get anything new in the intervening 6 to 8 weeks? There's another right in the HIPAA regulations that says that if you give your consent, they can pretty much do what they want, right, so long as you give your consent. Now, the deal is your consent, they can't premise the provision of medical care on your giving that consent. What does that mean to me in practice? When you're handed a sheaf of papers as you come into the hospital with your broken arm, at the bottom of one of the sheets where you say, please sign all this stuff, it says at the bottom, by the way, you don't have to sign this form in order to get your care. But, you know, it's practice for everybody to sign it. I think a lot of people would sign the form. Now, instead of having a patient advocate there to tell you maybe you shouldn't sign the form, it's kind of like Miranda warning, you know, have the jailhouse attorney say, just don't say anything. Instead of that kind of response, it might be good to be able to change your mind very easily, to actually log on to your own records by wandering down to the hospital or do it through a secure connection on the internet and say, first of all, who up to this minute has looked at my stuff? Let me see if Procter & Gamble or my doctor has more interest in my records. And second, you know what? On review, maybe I want to change my mind. I want to take it back. I know I gave permission for X, Y, and Z, but I don't want that anymore. These are exactly the kinds of things built into Stephen King's e-book. And I think we could do justice to the issues at stake in privacy to think about what the systems would like if we were to implement it for privacy. And my guess is that those who benefit from the data, the healthcare companies, the insurance companies, could actually be quite happy with a scheme like this because it helps delineate the boundaries for them very clearly. Once they're agreed to and once they're in the software, you could even create a safe harbor that says, if you just use the software as it's been certified under the standards process, you're fine. When the software says don't do this, you better not do it. When the software allows you, you have some form of immunity. So anyway, I wanted to be as provocative as possible. You'll see the details of this proposal in excruciating detail in a penultimate draft that ended up in the Stanford Law Review in the big binder under the tab for this section in an essay I wrote. And with that, I should finish. So thank you.
I'm just so glad we got Aristotle into this. Why don't we take just a few questions? I know we're running a little bit short on time, but let me see if anybody has any questions for our very good panelists. Anybody? Thoughts? All right, well, with that, we'll take a short break. Oh, yeah.
Are you asking me under the HIPAA regulations?
Let me repeat the question because of the webcam. The question is, how does access or alteration work under the new HIPAA regulations?
But the way access works is we'll take it from the point of view of a provider. A patient would probably write a note or a letter to the provider saying, I'd like to see a copy of my health records. And the provider would probably copy them because they never let their hands off the originals. When the patient would see that notation, maybe the doctor thinks that the person's an alcoholic and the person strongly disagrees with that, then the person would send the doctor a request to amend that, saying, what do you base this on? This is erroneous information. The patient does not have the right to have that information expunged from their records. It's only a right to supplement. And there's a very strong policy reason for that, as I'm sure you can all imagine. If somebody's been, for instance, if there's been a misdiagnosis in the past and somebody's been receiving treatment for that, it's very important for future health care providers to know exactly what's been going on all along.
Yeah, that's an excellent answer.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We'll convene the roundtable in 5 minutes.
Thanks
a lot. Thank you.
I've got my right here. But
listen, it's okay.
No, no.
I'm not saying you're wrong. I've got to be
telling
you.
Let me look at that one.
Right. All right, the last thing I'm going to do is I'm going the wrong direction.
No, no, I'll look at my name again. No, that's just for some reason. I've got the actual right to see. I carry the supposedly I did it. I'm just telling my good friends of mine here. They pushed me in.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, let's move.
I just want to make sure I'm not seeing.
Yeah, I know what your concern is.
I mean, I've been a lot of
Oh. Oh, okay.
Can everybody take their seats? We're going to spend our last session in kind of a different format. Professor Nicholas Allard is here. He's a partner at Latham & Watkins, teaches at George Mason University. He's been with us today watching the proceedings, and what we've asked him to do is kind of see if he can provoke a little discussion or raise a few eyebrows with respect to the materials that we've heard today. So, Professor Allard?
Thank you, General DiPolitano. I think I'll come out front and try to do my cross between Bobby Bautista and Arthur Miller, wander around. It's a pleasure to come here and be with you from the entertainment capital of the world, Washington, D.C. I guess Jonathan Citran was right. There aren't that many differences between the West Coast and the East Coast. This is the last session where the intention is to give the audience the maximum amount of chance to say something. You've been sitting out there all day long trying to catch a sip from a fire hydrant, I think, at some points. And now's the chance for you to really weigh in and participate. Just a couple of ground rules. Because we are webcasting, I'm going to hand off the mic to whoever wants to make a comment or question. Second, because we're all the last thing that the others have, we're standing between the audience and the reception. I think, you know, just be advised when you're making your comments. And third, you know, we'll try to reduce commercialization and focus on you know, intellectual academic aspects. The one exception would be any members of that august group, SAGE, the Society of Attorneys General Emeriti, as Andy Miller might want to call it, are exempted from that prohibition. It was interesting to see just a couple of observations that we'll just try to jump out and take your questions or comments, or maybe I'll pose a few. Interesting to see Jonathan Citrain in the morning begin with a reference to 1400 A.D. and then conclude here with a reference to Aristotle. Going backwards, moving backwards to talk about information technology of the 21st century. Well, you know, he's really right to do that. I mean, he really is right to do that because human perspectives on information technology have remained the same over the years and centuries and millennia. And in fact, if we look to history, we can see that the human race has had been troubled, been perplexed by the introduction of every information technology every time it's occurred. I'm not making it up. For example, the introduction of writing to ancient man and women, was as disturbing in many respects as some of our new information technology. For example, the first reference to writing in the Western tradition is in the Iliad, two places where it occurs, and in both places Homer shows this great unease and distrust. The phrase that he uses in Greek is ominous symbols. In one of those occasions, the Greek hero Bellerophon is taking a message, a coded message, because he's illiterate. He's a hero, but he can't read, kind of like Rambo, I think. He's taking it to a distant king, and like the double cross in Shakespeare's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, the message is, kill the bearer of this message. So that it reflects a great distrust, and the usage is very similar to the debates we see now over government encryption and the ability of the government to have access to understanding and breaking codes. Now, Socrates was one of history's great cranks. I think that's one of the reasons why they offed him with hemlock. But he railed against, in the 5th century before our common era, the introduction of paper, when that started coming into Greece from Egypt. And he felt, well, there's been a paper written about this. It's called If Socrates Had Email. All his complaints about the introduction of paper sound similar to concerns people have about email. Now, his protege, equally cranky and so on, Plato, complained a lot about Greek drama. Too much sex, too much violence, never knew when to bring the kids. So you can see that throughout history we have, you know, over and over and over again, very similar kinds of experiences. I would just commend to all of you, just to really fast forward and bring it up to speed a little bit more, there's a wonderful little book, very readable, by Tom Standage, S-T-A-N-D-A-G-E. It's called The Victorian Internet. It's paperback. He's a former science editor of The Guardian. And it's a wonderful book. It shows how everything that we're experiencing right now in spades was experienced with the first advent of electronic communications, with the introduction of the telegraph, which became the Victorian Internet. In fact, even the words for the first message shows the somewhat uncertainty, the ambiguity, the concern. What hath God wrought, when the first telegraph message was sent, at least in the United States, from Baltimore to Washington, D.C. Well, that's observation number one, is that history can be, you know, somewhat comforting to us. The second observation is that efforts by government lawmakers, law enforcers, to do the balancing that General Riley talked about early this morning, takes time. It takes an awful lot of time. And it was in this institution that the concept was first popularized of the right to be left alone, the famous 1896 Law Review article. I think it got Brandeis tenure. I may be wrong about that. I think it also concerned some salacious facts about a Harvard faculty member that became public, and it was his outrage over that that led him to this Law Review article. I may be making that up, so somebody from this institution, I'm sure, will correct me if I'm wrong. It wasn't until the mid-1920s in the Olmstead case where that phrase made it. It was a wiretapping case busting some Seattle-based rum runners. And the right to be left alone was in the dissent by Brandeis, and then that concept, recognition of a privacy right in the United States Constitution, wasn't embodied, I think, until the 1960s in some other cases, unrelated really to information technology, more about health privacy, medical privacy kind of issues. So you can see that grappling with these things does take a lot of time. I was interested, by the way, to see there were a couple of comments during the day as if, well, you know, we're always in this country used to limiting the government's power to collect and invade privacy. And I thought that was kind of odd, because the Privacy Act of 74, which is really a seminal piece of legislation in that regard, was kind of late in arriving and passed only because, as has been noted, Watergate. I mean, there was no accident that the floor manager of that 1974 act was Sam Ervin. I felt very deeply about the Watergate abuses, and that's what really helped move that legislation forward. Okay, picking up on another Zittran concept, and that's just to be incremental, I was trying to be cute, I thought, and just pick things that were overlooked, but everything was eventually covered. You know, I was grudgingly striking out, I'll cover that, and it's very hard to find things that weren't covered, but one thing that sort of stood out, it was only mentioned really obliquely at lunch by Senator Cantwell, was property rights, and the concept of privacy as a property right. And the interesting thing to me was that in the real very fine Stanford conference that the Attorney General's and NAG hosted, such a wonderful acronym, NAG, love it. I'm so glad it's not NASA. It's just much better as NAG. But in that Stanford conference, there was considerable discussion about the possibility that property rights would form a sort of a framework of principles to address privacy issues. Also, it was discussed in the Seattle conference, the annual conference, the annual meeting of the Attorney General's, and then recently in the March 1st hearings before the House Energy and Commerce Committee, only one of the several academic witnesses addressed it and really objected to the application of property principles. So it's kind of interesting. Maybe we do have any law students. If there's any law student in here on a day like today, it'd probably be totally damaging to their reputation. But if there's any law student here today, they might be able to make a contribution and give us their insights on that aspect. But otherwise, just about everything that you would have wanted had covered was covered. One of the things I don't think was made as explicit as it might have been, everybody knows this, but I'll just repeat it. I mean, it's easy, so I'll be able to take a swipe at it, is that privacy is, when we're talking about privacy, we're talking about many, many, many different things. Different things. And it's also different things to different people. We're talking about intrusion. We're talking about identity theft. We're talking about false light, misappropriation of likenesses or identity. And I know I'm missing several. We're talking about security. And in some instances, we're talking about crimes that might reach over and then be feel like they're addressing a privacy issue. So we're talking about many, many different things. And then also this notion that privacy is subjective. Now, some people are perfectly willing to get a discount at the Safeway or Giant or Kroger or whatever for a discount card, but in return have it known how many Krispy Kremes they order a week. Other people are a little bit uncomfortable about that. So people feel differently, very, very differently about privacy. One of the things that privacy is that's different, I was a little surprised that it didn't quite get as much attention today, and that's, and maybe it will tomorrow, is anonymity. And, you know, this is a tough one because there are many instances where state attorney generals, law enforcement authorities are going to want and uphold anonymity, say if there's a whistleblower or if somebody who's in a compromised situation is seeking help or wants some advice. And you can see in many situations where anonymity is good. In other contexts, you know, if you're voting in a recall, and what state is it? Is it Nevada that permits online voting for a recall? Arizona? Arizona, yeah. You probably want, if there's ever going to be online voting or in a ballot, any kind of ballot situation, you want anonymity. Other situations, it's not so good. If you're a sexual predator and you're targeting children and you're holding yourself out to be another child and you're communicating online with children, that kind of anonymity is not so good. If you're engaged in an online transaction and you're faking who you are and kind of hiding behind that fake identity and you're anonymous in that regard, that's not so good. So anonymity is really a very, very important issue and that really bears close attention. The final thing that really will probably get some more attention tomorrow than it did today, it was implicit in just about everything, was the sort of challenge of obtaining harmonization of multiple conflicting legal jurisdictions and the vast complexity of the issue, what we're talking about. The complexity is just almost mind-boggling. If you look at the HIPAA regulations that we were just talking about, I think there were there's certainly over 50,000 comments. There may have been 100,000 comments filed. The regulations, you know, to publish multiple copies will kill a lot of trees unless they're made available exclusively online. They're very, very complex. But then just, you know, thinking we're talking about 50 different states with potential different privacy rules, which is not a break in tradition. We've largely had common law approach that's varied from state to state, and that's been tolerated. I don't agree with the comment that that's somehow, you know, constitutionally suspect. I think it's completely consistent with the approach, for example, on pornography and other areas where we've permitted community standards, permitted states to be local laboratories for change. I think that was another Brandeis insight. But it's extremely complex, and tomorrow we'll be hearing about the new Canadian law, which is markedly different from the European law, which is markedly different from the United States law, and you've got 15 members of the EU who are still permitted to have tougher laws than the EU. And some of them may be, you know, encouraged to go out and make examples of folks in other countries for whatever reason they might. Canada has 10 privacy principles. Sure, you hear about that. One of them didn't even come up today at all. One of them is, in terms of talking about access, an obligation to eliminate data that you've collected once the use that you've collected it for expires. I got to go back out and erase the blackboard. I'm wondering, in application, you know, if you've transferred that on, how far your obligation extends to go after others that may now hold that information and make sure that it's eliminated. So very, very great. And even in Canada, you know, Quebec has its own privacy rule. Surprise. And that increases the complexity. The United States, the Graham Leach Bliley financial rules have an amendment that Senator Sarbanes put in that permits states to have their own and tougher financial security rules. So just almost mind-numbing complexity, and the good news is that that's a very constructive role for government leaders and state AGs to have, and that is to try to work together to kind of sort out what do you do when we have a completely seamless networked world with different legal jurisdictions based on old geographies. That's my filibuster, and I really want to give a chance to open this up, but I think probably the best place to start is the question that was put by our host in the materials that you have. And as I was listening to this, I think it's probably the central question, listening to the whole program today. This whole topic is so vast, so huge. The first question that's put by General Riley is, what is the best role for attorney generals and other state-based enforcement? And, you know, you think about that, what should there be a priority? should they try to be, should state attorney generals be involved in all the issues across the board, or because of the lack of resources, or maybe just the demands on resources, you could perform some kind of triage and focus in some areas? And if so, are there some areas that are more important or lend themselves more to state enforcement authority? So I kind of toss that question out, hope somebody will take a bite. And I know a lot of you SAGE members, so if nobody jumps in, I may start picking on you. But who wants to take a swipe at that question that General Riley put? I'm looking right at Jeff Modisette, so he's not going to duck. Go ahead, take a swipe. And here's the mic.
I think it goes back to one of the points that you've already made, and that is that when we got together at Stanford last year, one of the goals was to make sure that the attorneys general didn't take just solely a law enforcement perspective to this fabulous medium and this new technology of the Internet, and to have a broad-based understanding of it. And I think that the AGs have really done a remarkably good job over the last 12 months or 14 months now, because they've gotten involved not just in cyber crime issues, but in the whole policy debate over privacy and the whole policy debate over how do you conduct the balance that Attorney General Riley was referring to earlier. And I think that is what we were trying to achieve. So if we're to say priorities, I think we do need to take the AGs need to take a broad look at at all of these issues that are raised and not limit themselves just to traditional law enforcement perspectives, although clearly that's always going to be the expertise. For example, let's go back to privacy. I think it's been very valuable that the AGs have spoken out so forcefully on the issue of privacy that now there's no one in America who has any relevant role in this who doesn't know that it's a big issue whether or not the AGs are going to have at least law enforcement authority on what on the privacy issues for any federal legislation. And I think that if we hadn't had our conferences and hadn't had our debates and formed our committees, if the AGs hadn't, that might not have taken place. So I think the key is to stay involved and to look at all these issues while keeping in the back of our minds that still the AG's law enforcement authority is perhaps the most important of all these issues. If I were to pose one question, if I could, just to keep it going here, you mentioned access, and one of the things that I was thinking about, and I think it may have been Chris Kelly who made the excellent point about how important access was as a question, but there are so many costs involved. And one of the things that kept occurring to me is, you know, access is important so that we know what information is held, but, and I think you touched upon this too, how good is that if we don't have the ability to make the sort of changes, or whether it's purging or correcting or explaining the information that is possessed about us? And yet, if you talk about cost, my God, I just can't even imagine the costs that are involved in trying to amend information once we learn about it. And for those who are in the private sector here or in private corporations, I would ask for comments on that issue.
Well, it'd be interesting to get some comments on the access question that he's just posed. Somebody was saying that it was a new thing, or it hadn't happened yet, about accessing information online, and I guess that was the Hiawatha. You know, and change the data without people knowing. I mean, that was a central part of Ferris Bueller when he accessed his report card. It's been everybody's dream for years. Anybody have any comments on access and where the line should be? It's a very tough question, hasn't received as much comment. Anybody?
Well, it does raise an issue that I think, as attorneys general, we're going to have to focus on, and that's the whole issue of security of the data. The notion that somebody can infiltrate a system and make changes without the system's knowledge or anyone else's knowledge was a fairly spine-chilling notion, I thought, this morning. And it seems to me that although we all have fun with our hacker cases and so forth, that if our job is public protection, there is a big gap in the system there. I don't know what the feds are doing about it, if anything, but certainly we as state attorneys general, I think, have a responsibility here. And with respect to division of labor between the state and the feds, you know, we just cannot have a system where all enforcement in the Internet world is left to the federal government, because if you want to look at where the resources are for law enforcement, it is not at the federal level. It is at the state level. That's where the investigators and the prosecutors are, by and large. And particularly, I think, the more removed you get from either coast, the presence of federal law enforcement is very dissipated, and it makes it all the more important for state officials to be there and armed with enforcement authority.
Sort of a segue into the next question that General Riley posed in his materials. If you believe that the attorney generals have a broad role and they should be deeply involved across the board, and I may be misstating, I don't mean to be characterizing what you were saying. Yeah, in the debate, are there a need for new laws? Do you have all the tools that you need? Andrew Miller.
Homeowners insurance policy. I wanted to follow up on the point that General Napolitano mentioned, because one of the things that I found interesting about this debate, and I think this is an extraordinarily valuable program, is the fact that one talks about enforcement by the states. I do not know of any responsible voice in the business community which is opposed to the attorneys general enforcing, obviously, the law of their own states, or federal law, if there is one. And there's a lot of semantical confusion over the use of the word preemption. Those who are in favor of preemption really are not saying there ought to be a preemption of state enforcement. It's a question of whether there ought to be preemption of a plethora of inconsistent state standards. And that's something I think which would be helpful to emphasize in terms of clarifying the debate as it goes forward. But one of the things that has struck me is the fact that with all this talk of enforcement by the states, I don't know what the situation is as of the present moment, but as of January 1st of this year, 26 of the 50 states had no statute relating to identity theft. Now, if the states are really interested in getting after the problem, which I think is on the forefront of Americans' concerns with respect to the use of the Internet and the abuses which those uses can be put to, you would think that it would be a primary item on the agenda to see that each state had an effective statute on this particular issue. When I say effective, even those 24 states which have a statute which can be denominated as addressing the identity theft issue, there are some which only have criminal penalties. Not that that's not important. Of course, it's very important. But, for example, do not have a private cause of action which an individual can file in order to recover damages, nor do they have a provision with respect to a protocol whereby an injured citizen can actually have his credit restored or her credit restored with a minimal effort compared to the effort now required on his or her part in order to accomplish that. And it seems to me that if one is going to talk about state enforcement, one really needs to move forward and say, look, we're serious. We're going to have statutes in the books of all 50 states that are comprehensive, criminal penalties, private cause of action, and the ability to restore credit with a protocol which everybody has signed off on. These are the things that really can be done at the state level in order to protect Americans, which are not being done at the present time. So I would like to throw this out as something which I would hope would be given serious consideration.
Thank you, Andy. That's a very interesting point. You know, there is move. Every state, it used to be all 49 except for Vermont, and I think Vermont has passed a computer crime state. General Sorrell were here. I'm sure he'd fill me in. And the common element of those statutes is, you've got company in 49 states, so you should be in pretty good shape. And the common element is, in most of them, they're all a little bit different, is the unauthorized access to a computer file, or if you gain access and then exceed the permission that was granted, then that amounts to potential criminal activity. And to follow up on Andy's point, we've got a responsibility not only with the 50 states, but we continue to have to remind ourselves we're in an international situation, and the love bug from the Philippines came in a situation where at least the Philippine law enforcement authority said they didn't have the correct statutory authority. I wonder if they would have said the same thing in the Marcos regime. I'm sure they would have found some applicable statute then. But and often there is applicability of other standard criminal statutes, but there is a great usefulness to getting specific criminal statutes passed. One thing that's been, and this may be too squishy and not of any interest to anybody in the room other than myself, but again, going back to this notion of privacy being very subjective, how do you develop rules in an area where people care differently about privacy? How do you hook up the difference between sort of social norms of what passes or doesn't pass for being appropriate and what is very different for different kinds of people? Anybody have any thoughts on that? Choice? Okay, well then, why don't you, just one word, I need a little more help than that.
We had a chorus over here of people saying you give consumers choice, and that takes care to a large extent of the subjectivity, because then consumers are in control of what they want or don't want in terms of privacy. Did you want to add?
What's the difference between choice and consent? You heard it sounds to me like that's something different than choice.
This is my own personal view. I think of consent as a subset of choice. Consent is a particular type of choice. And there's prior consent or opt-in, and then there's opt-out, which is a form of consent. Or it's a choice anyway. But I think of consent as a subset of choice. It's a particular kind.
Harris, you got anything to say on this?
I mean, nobody other than Ted Kaczynski would walk into Nordstrom's and say, Mr. Salesperson, before you can send me any information about your special, I have to sign a form that allows me to put your name in that salesperson's record. That's how Nordstrom's does it. And you made the point about historical. If you think back to 19th century America, everybody in town, in small town America, knew where everybody else was. In fact, even into the early 20th century, if you called up the local telephone operator and said, I'd like to talk to Mr. Kelly, the operator would say, well, Kelly's not in town. Kelly's out of town for the week, and I know his mother's still in town. You can talk to her if you really need to get a hold of him. Maybe she knows where he is. So this idea that somehow this is all a new aspect in the Internet, we need special rules, this is something that doesn't make any sense to me. People have lived with the idea that in basic commercial transactions, and even in society, other people know about them. And the idea that there's a big uprising of people who are concerned in the consumer area, again, I'm limiting it to the consumer area, about intrusions of privacy, I simply don't agree with. If you can give people technological solutions, consumers are not stupid. Consumers will take advantage of it. I went into another shopping store with my daughter, my 17-year-old daughter, the other day, and the salesperson asked her to fill out a form. I said, do you know why you're doing that? And she said, yeah, Dad, so they can market to me. My daughter's 16 years old. She just turned 17. I mean, she knew what she was doing. She knew what people were doing. So this idea that we have to have special laws to protect consumers online simply doesn't make any sense to me, as long as we give them the tools and industry standards are out there.
Well, yes, to a point. Now, you know, there's a great book on the origin of the jury trial by S.F.C. Milsom. I think we had him in law school. And he notes that your right to a jury trial was just a right to an impartial jury, but that you pick jurors from your small communities and hamlets because they knew everything. They can confirm that, yeah, that's Martin Gere, and yeah, he did take a duck. We knew about it, you know, and so on. And so it's kind of switched in a way I think is roughly analogous. But on the other hand, and I've been trying to sell my friend Jeff Modisett for 2 years these historic analogies, and he's saying, you know, look, first of all, folks out in Silicon Valley, you know, the attention span is a little bit shorter than, you know, talking about Aristotle and Plato. And also, look, that only works to a point. And Esther Dyson's book, released 2000, although it's pretty tough to read in some spots, in fact, most spots, has some really good stuff on the power of the power of this computer technology to take maybe trivial facts and combine them and collate them and come up with some potentially damaging facts that people will find or uncomfortable. You know, and it's sort of this Chinese water torture. I can be politically incorrect because they still got our plane. You know, where you drib and drab a little bit, fact, and then you're able to put it together. I'll try to tell this story, but for me it keeps it simple. I'll try to tell this story about, it makes this point. There's a priest, Father Kelly, who's celebrating his 50th anniversary of his ordination, and he's having a cocktail with the people at his celebration, and they're saying, Father Kelly, what is the most memorable aspect of being a priest for 50 years? And he says, well, you know, I've thought about that, and it's just easy. For me, it's hearing confession. It's hearing confession. In fact, the very first time I heard confession, a person in the confessional confessed to having committed a murder. And then later on in the evening, a very prominent member of the community came in, and he was being introduced to Father Kelly. He says, no, you don't have to introduce him to me. In fact, I was the first person who he ever heard confession. And so you put those two, okay, you got it. I think Miller's position is safe anyway. I think we're approaching that hour. If anybody has any burning comment or question, I'd be happy to take one more and then maybe just end with just some very brief observations. And that is that, is there anybody that has a question or comment that they want to really, you're so terrific and unselfish and so much want to get out on that beautiful day. That's great. The progress that lawmakers are making and law enforcement authority are making with grappling with the balancing that General Riley talked about today is slow but steady, and you know that's okay. Many of the privacy issues that we hear and see about today seem familiar, and that's because they are. They go back at least to the founding of this country. Other privacy issues seem acute sometimes because they involve sort of a disconnect or a train wreck between different jurisdictions, the European authority perhaps, and the United States privacy laws, or because they touch people that we feel need to be protected, or they touch a moral nerve, say situations involving children. But you know, either familiarity or contempt is not really an adequate grounds to create and impose a massive regulatory structure on this area, or certainly not anything new. At least that's my personal perspective. It certainly, we have to think whether we take the heavy regulatory structure, which now, as we're moving into new competitive era, has been discredited, in applying the regulatory structure that was applied to broadcast and telephone and cellular phones and other innovations. And in fact, you know, now that we know, it's kind of slowed down the advent and effectiveness and the delivery to the public of the benefits of those new technologies. And so, you know, I want to think hard about jumping to impose new heavy regulations on these legacy regulations on these newcomers. There's lots of other options, including letting competition. You know, we've heard a lot about privacy cells, I think. That's one way of phrasing what you've heard about. And that, you know, of all the folks that are out there on the Internet, it's commercial interest that their brand becomes synonymous with straight dealing, straight shooting. And then if you can understand what they're offering, whether it's more or less, I mean, that should work. Go a long way because it empowers consumers to really not only self-help but understand what they're getting into, and we can see more in the way of technology providing security and providing assistance. Still a very, very important role for law enforcement authorities. The FTC has been doing a pretty good job in going out and after outliers. Without knowing the specifics of the case, I just note that there were three cases filed last week by the Federal Trade Commission under the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. So, you know, very much useful to enforce laws, go after outliers, not necessarily regulate, but show folks where the norms are. And then again, another role for government certainly is to work towards this accommodation and struggle through this multiplicity of jurisdictions that we have. So, you know, the search for the proper balance is not likely to end very soon. It could be never ending. It's a constant tension. We've got established rules that govern commercial activity and personal interactions that apply if you use 19th or 20th century means of communications. if you slip down a wormhole, it's not yet at all clear what those rules should be, but it's not going to be that much clearer tomorrow. I bet we've got a long way off to work toward resolving those issues. Thanks very much. This has been a terrific program, and congratulations to Chris Milliken, Lynn Ross, and NAG for putting it on.
Thanks, Professor. I think we're breaking now for the reception. Can people leave their materials in this room tonight? If you want to leave your 5-pound tomes here, unless you're going to study it tonight, that'd be good. And then, where is the reception, Chris?